Turn on. We'll take them start.
He's made it his bar.
Do you know if you have some school account? Would it like to go to the one that turned around and I had it?
No, they sit in and.
No, well, yeah, well, you know, you got a group of kids to take care of that. Yeah, this is a problem. So that's a good challenge.
Or that should be.
That's for sure.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Thank God. Hi, Tim.
How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Good.
Good morning.
Hello. Good, how are you?
Did you do that last week?
They didn't turn up. The scowling.
Red face.
What are we going to do with these pictures?
We read the front line.
When our home address is in line.
But not around the way area. Actually,
So are you, so you're announcing that I should do something with my face like smaller?
So, you know, with that in mind, I'm just
Where are you sitting, Scott?
I'm down here.
Okay. Now, are we supposed to look pleasant, like smile?
However you would like to be portrayed.
Or serious.
Very serious. Don't mess with me.
Or am I going to run for something again?
Yeah. We were calling you. I think they were picking up on something that they sent in regarding issue of stolen.
Better be good. Makes sense.
Okay.
So do we. I'm sure.
Overwhelmed?
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I may need your help. Give it your best campaign. Might be getting jerked.
Sorry, I was just saying, I'm going to get a little closer to you.
you want to, let me know how to deal with the cops, I'll tell you that. I hope I said it, yes. Here you go.
Can I get one more thing?
Here's the water.
There's at least one on the phone.
Hi, it's Tom Borden. Who's on the phone?
Debbie.
Hi, Debbie.
How are you?
Good. Anyone else on the phone?
Maybe my dog, if she doesn't keep quiet.
I'm afraid that she's not a voting member, but...
She isn't, but she is a member of the public and a Highlands resident. You know? So I say that because, you know, I may, like, walk upstairs and all of a sudden you hear a bark. You know, if it gets out of hand, somebody tell me something.
Okay. Will do. Thanks.
So it's good.
Okay, one more.
Oh, okay, thanks.
It is, but if you need to.
Thank you.
It's okay if you need
to. Good morning. I want to call to order this 53rd meeting of the New Jersey Highlands Water Protection and Planning Council. My name is John Weingart. I live in Surgeonsville in Hunterdon County. Ask the other members to introduce themselves.
Tanisha Way, Passaic County Freeholder. Mimi Les, Persephone.
Tim Dillingham, a public member.
Jazz Kovach, town of Clinton, Hunterdon County.
Scott Wignack, Morristown.
Tracy Carluccio, public representative, Hunterdon County.
And on the telephone?
Debbie Pascarelli, Warren County.
Okay. Eric Peterson, can you hear me?
Yep.
Hunterdon County Freeholder.
Okay, good morning, Debbie. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning.
We have a quorum, and we expect several other members to be joining us during the morning, or at least one or two. This meeting was advertised in accordance with the Open Public Meetings Act and publicized on the Highlands Council website as well. All who wish, please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
The flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We have in our packets minutes from the last meeting, August 16th. We'll do them separately. We have minutes of the full meeting and the executive session. Let's take the minutes of the full meeting first.
Excuse me.
Yes.
No minutes.
No minutes for the public. Okay.
We can make copies.
Okay, we'll make copies and we'll defer that discussion until later on. Sorry for that. We'll do later. This is, well, I'll get to that in a minute, but there's a meeting scheduled for the upcoming meetings of the council that, if that's not on the table, that will be shortly. It's had an annotated meeting schedule in the New Jersey Highlands Council, so that will be available to all. The next meeting of the council is 2 weeks from today, September 20th, Thursday at 10 a.m. We have several, as you know, as members know, we have a fairly intense schedule of council meetings over the next couple of months. We're meeting pretty much every 2 weeks as a full council. We are also scheduling several subcommittee meetings. I know this is a strain on members' time, and I appreciate the flexibility everyone's able to offer to this. As much as possible. We have a budget and finance committee set up for September 19th at 1:30, transfer development rights committee meeting for October 11th at 4 p.m., and the natural resources committee tentatively to be in 2 weeks after the council meeting on September 20th. And we'll confirm those with members and get them on the council website. Other than that, I only apologize that we can't move the meeting outdoors. I thank the staff for providing such gorgeous weather. Any members have items they wish to report on at this time? Okay, well, we're going to move into the meat of the meeting. This meeting is the, to some extent, the first of a series of work sessions we're going to have devoted to putting together the revised draft plan for public comment. We all received a number of documents over the last week and a half, which are now available to the public as well, which are going to form the basis of presentation and discussion this morning. This meeting will be different than the ones that follow. The ones that follow, beginning with the next one, we will be focusing on text that's a draft part of, proposed by staff as a draft part of the plan. Where we will be looking at text that if we say we are comfortable with it, that will be what goes into the plan. The paper we're talking about today is a series of issues and concepts that we need to discuss that are important in terms of forming what's going to follow in our discussions. What we're going to do with this meeting and the ones that follow is have these as informal a discussion among council members as we can. To have a chance to ask questions and make comments and try to see where there may be areas of contention or disagreement among us where we need to provide some direction as a group to the council, to the staff and the consultants to move forward. This will be less an issue I'm about to say today than in the future meetings, but it will be somewhat an issue. We have a lot of issues to cover in a relatively short period of time. We don't have a set closing time for this meeting, but I know at least one member has to leave at noon, he does, but I think the discussion is likely to go later than that. So, two things. One is, to the extent anyone has very specific comments that are factual errors or typographical errors or where language might be better one way than another, I think as much as possible as we can all give those to the staff and give those to our changes to Eileen or suggestions, rather than having them be part of the discussion here, that would be good. The other is I'm going to have to try to move the discussion along from time to time, so if we get a topic out on the table, once we have a chance to hear what different people think about it, it may be necessary to move us on to the next topic, because if we don't get through the agenda, we're going to back up on the schedule we've put forward, and we'll have to change that. We could do, but I think all of us would like to avoid that if at all possible. So with that, let's move into that part of the schedule, which will be basically, in terms of the agenda, items 7 and 10. We don't have any committee reports. There are no committees that have met since our last council meeting, I don't believe. Do want to consider the election of a new treasurer, since Debbie Pascarelli, after laboring long and hard as our faithfully as our treasurer and budget committee chair, has decided she's not going to do that anymore, so we'll do that later on in the meeting. But I want to move into the substance of the discussion and combine 7 and 10, both the executive director's report as sort of an introduction to the discussion of policy issues for the development plan, and introduce Diane Swan, our executive director, and Charlie Seaman, our consultant. Eric and Debbie, you can hear okay?
John, I'm still having a bit of a problem. Maybe it's my equipment, but I think if the council members use the microphones, I think we'll be okay.
Okay. And let me ask also, can members of the public hear in the back? Because I know we've had some problems in the past. Okay. Just raise your hand if you're having trouble hearing anything.
Mr. Chairman, members of the council, I'd just like to make a short introductory set of remarks about what we're here to do today. We've established a very aggressive work program to deliver a draft, next generation draft of the regional master plan by mid-November. There are a number of matters that we have been working, the staff has been working on, and we have been assisting about how we're going to go forward. And they involve some policy assumptions. And the purpose of this meeting today is to bring those to your attention, explain to you what the considerations are, and to let you know what we intend to do going forward, so that when you start getting draft elements of the plan, it won't be a surprise what we're out there, what we're doing. And the reason for that is some of these are very important issues that have not been really resolved in prior efforts, and we simply can't meet the deadline if a month from now, when you're looking at a substantive element, why did you all do it this way? Why did you follow this course? We're not asking you to take a vote on a policy. We're asking you to share your concerns, your ideas, so that, and I likened it last time I was before you to the wedding ceremony. Speak now, or please hold your questions in the future, because we've got to start moving forward and moving forward very rapidly to meet the aggressive deadline. And so it's a workshop, and we're most interested in your thoughts, ideas, concerns, so we can understand what your preference is as a consensus, not as a vote, and be mindful of those concerns as we go forward. Eileen?
Thank you. Good morning. We decided that it was best to sort of roll the executive director's report into sort of the introduction to these policy issues, because really the work that we've been doing in the past, I think it's 2.5 weeks or so, has really been in preparation for today's meeting. And so that's why we chose to do it in this manner. We've been working on, for the past couple of weeks, the staff in-house and then back and forth with the consultant team as well, to be ready for today and bring these issues to you. I think what's important to say, and if I'm restating what Charlie said, I apologize, but I think it's important to keep in mind that what we're doing here is setting forth the road, the path to, you know, and to where conclusions will be reached later. Today is not a day where we're delivering conclusions. We're really delivering the progress that we've made, and so that as we move forward and various components of the plan are revealed, you understand where those differences have come from. For example, when you have a land use capability map that is delivered to you, you will be talking today about the indicators that will be informing that, so that it does indeed become a capability map. So the purpose today then is to set forth, you know, a progress report really, and to show you where we are, the direction we're taking, so that the public and the council members all see that we are indeed responding to the comments received, and the next generation is truly that. It is what you've seen before, but it's been reinformed by the comments we've received from both yourselves and the public. The other part of this is that in preparation for today, a very important part of our work is coordination with state agencies. As we continue our work and have a plan, we're going to be working very closely with other agencies that have tasks to do that intersect with what we're doing. And so it's critical that we work together. And, you know, it's one state and the plan responds to our needs, and it also is done in coordination with those other agencies. So since we've last met, we've had a series of meetings on state coordination. We've met with the Office of Smart Growth and State Planning Commission. I attended a meeting of the Plan Implementation Committee, which is a subcommittee of the State Planning Commission. And we've been continuing our work on an MOU with them, and actually we'll be setting up another subcommittee meeting with the State Agency Coordination Committee of this group to discuss that MOU and its progress. State Planning Commission members are also looking at that for the first time, and this current draft for the first time. So we're moving forward on that. And some of what we will be talking about today will relate back to that meeting with Ben Spinelli of Office of Smart Growth. We also had a meeting with the Department of Agriculture. It was the second meeting that we've had in a few weeks' time. And again, there will be issues that we will be speaking about as they pertain to agricultural resource area and prioritization for preservation that came out of those meetings. We had a meeting with the Department of Transportation and New Jersey Transit to again go over some of the comments that they had delivered to us on the draft plan, as we did with other agencies, and to show them how we are responding to their comments. The last meeting we had, two in fact, were with Department of Environmental Protection to work on issues with them, again, where we intersect on questions as for water availability and septic density. I am pleased to tell you that all of these meetings were both very productive and very positive. And I feel that we've got a very good relationship established with each of the organizations or state agencies we've been meeting with, and each of the key staff in those agencies. So that in preparation for today, each of those agencies has expressed very much support for the progress we're making and the issues we're bringing to you today. I think all of that is very important. We've continued to have meetings with townships that come to us for assistance or for informational type meetings, and I laid those out for you. Clinton Township and Township of Hardiston were two that we had, and we have more upcoming ones with Califon Borough is one that we already are planning to do. We continue to meet with the county planners, and we've had a meeting with the New Jersey Highlands Coalition as well. So we'll continue to do those meetings at the same time. Now, that brings us then to the policy issues memo that you've received and that is now before the public as well. And Charlie and I will we'll go back and forth on this as needed, and to put these issues before you, and also to respond to you with either concerns or questions that you may have. The first issue that we bring up today is the lands model, what was known as the land use capability map, the results of which you see around the room, was the result of a tool that was put together, the LUCM tool as it was called, now renamed the lands model, and it is indeed a different model in that it is GIS based, not raster based, as was the last model. It is a model that is far more user friendly and capable of intelligence, so you can make certain decisions and they can be fed into the model. We have run that model. The GIS department has worked very, very hard over the last few weeks to test that model to make sure it does perform, and indeed it does. So we've been very pleased that we now have a working model. Then it is a refined model from the previous one you've seen, and at the end of the discussion today, I hope what you will see is that it's a bit good. The new model will be very responsive to the comments received, and will indeed deliver a land use capability map where the capability component will be far clearer. So the next number of issues that we go through relate to the lands model. The first one of those is lake communities. From many people and many organizations and of course council members, we received many comments on these lake communities. The development of what's known as the planned community zone or the specially planned areas basically is if a certain density or land use pattern has already been achieved on those lands, they are colored in that purple. In other words, they already have achieved a certain density. So they are, to a certain extent, developed lands. And if they meet those bars, they were colored purple. Now, the question then that arose was the concern is, are those then areas that are considered appropriate for growth? And clearly it was seen as you looked at the mapping that no, there may be areas within them that are capable of potential growth, remembering always that any growth is discretionary. But there are also clearly areas within them that are not suitable for growth and shouldn't be considered as such. And the first case was those lake communities. So in order to come up with a way of handling that issue, we've done a great deal of work with the staff and with Charlie's team, and we've come up with a way to map it so that in the next generation, in that land use capability map, where you have those planned community zones, you will be able to see sub-areas within them, which will clearly delineate those lake areas and will clearly show you that there are areas within those purple zones that around these lakes where no further development should occur. And the tiering or sub-areas around the lake, we have a 1,000-foot shoreline district, which will show land use capability standards and water quality standards, primarily to be focused on continuous pollutant sources that can contribute pollutants overland or through groundwater over longer distances. Those standards will be developed and implemented for that 1,000-foot shoreline district. There will be another zone, a 300-foot zone, for lake ecosystem standards and water quality standards. That will address direct impact on the lakes. And further, there's a visual or scenic district, which will be a 300-foot minimum to a 1,000-foot maximum that will be delineated based on the size and the layout of the lake. There's also here an opportunity for further development and further analysis. With improved technology, this plan will always be evolving. We will have the opportunity to use LIDAR into the future, and that will allow us then to look at these lake districts from a drainage perspective, which will be very suitable and very beneficial to us. We don't have that technology available to us today, but we're already putting a place marker in the plan to say that we will be continuing to work on this issue and we will use the LIDAR when we have that. But in the meantime, we have a strategy and we'll be able to map it in the way that I've just outlined so that, again, when you have the next iteration of the map, it will show capacity around these lakes clearly. Now, it will be in either of two forms. It will be in either an overlay or it will be an indicator, so it will be fed into the model. But either way, in the end analysis, in the land use capability map, you will see this tiered approach. I'm stopping now to see if anybody has any questions or comments they'd like to make on that.
I had a question. Some of the lakes, do they drain different up 14s?
I'll pose that one, Dan.
The Highlands region has lakes all over the place. Each one of them will have a drainage area that is tributary to it. Those will not necessarily be an entire 14 subwatershed, or it may be multiple subwatersheds. And so the issue with the LIDAR mapping is that many of them are so small and their watersheds are so small that we don't really have a way of delineating them now.
So that's where I was getting at. The LIDAR will give us that more specific information because you can't assume that it's 114 or,
Yes. And so we will get to there. And that frankly, if you excuse me, things are Dan, was Dan's preference, but we need the LIDAR to do it in that manner.
And what is the timeline on that?
Actually, I got an email from Roger this morning on LIDAR, and I will admit, I just glanced at it. Roger, will you tell us when the LIDAR will be there?
It's scheduled to be delivered in the end of October.
But given our timelines, we certainly don't want to do the analysis in time for this plan using the LIDAR because it would take us from other tasks. So we need to have a methodology right now that we can use and a strategy that is appropriate, and then we will work with the LIDAR to further refine our analysis.
I'm sorry, I could not hear Roger. When is the LIDAR going to be available?
At the end of October, Debbie.
And I have a clarification question. Is this the executive director's report, or is this the council reviewing this 11-page memo and looking for our comments?
We have moved from one to the other, so we are now in the discussion of the 11-page memo.
And I'm on, Debbie, I'm on issue number two, which is the Lake Communities, which
yes,
is...
Yes, I'm with you.
Okay, thank you.
I would just like to comment, I recall an experience in my town where there was a lake, and there's at least four lake communities in Parsippany, where a development that was actually taking place in another town beyond 1,000 feet or anything, because they hadn't protected it, the silt runoff, it caused terrible damage to that small lake. And we found ourselves unable to do anything about it because the enforcing body was in another town and they didn't really care. And so I think we have to almost go beyond that for circumstances like that and have maybe the DEP or some enforcing body that when these things are detected or reported that they could come and enforce them and, you know, impose huge fines when these things happen, because it was an awful thing to happen.
I think what you're saying really goes to what we're trying to do here, in that regional planning is the way to best protect resources, because municipal planning often doesn't get to it, and it also gets to the desire to use the LIDAR, because then it's the full drainage area to the lake, and it's better than, you know...
There has to be some enforcing agency that realizes this.
Yes.
So we'll get to that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just to go back to the lands model for a second.
Excuse me, let's bring it back. Go ahead. Yeah.
Does the model change the analysis that was done around the indicators that was used to define?
I'm sorry, I cannot hear you.
I'm sorry, Debbie. I was asking whether or not the second iteration of the model changes the methodology that utilized the indicators which created the protection zones, conservation zones, and the planned community zones.
The model we have just run uses the exact same 51 indicators that was used in the original.
Right.
However, what we're suggesting today as I go through these different issues is that we will be adding indicators to the lands model that will further inform those zones. But you will still end up with the three basic zones in either planning or preservation area, they will still be there. But they will be further refined and informed through the addition of other indicators. We will also be taking a closer look at the indicators to make sure that in a review that we'll be making sure that there's nothing that's duplicative, and we'll bring that back to you should we find anything like that. So we are reviewing the whole process.
Okay.
Any
questions?
Quick question. In developing these extra overlays for the lake communities, are we doing so to ensure two things? One statement will probably be that we don't want to encourage future development in the lake areas because of the sensitivity of degradation of water quality in the lakes leading to sea levels. But also recognizing, though, that there might be a need for infrastructure improvement in terms of utilities to help protect the water quality. That was sort of the conflict we had the last go around.
My answer is yes in both cases. It's to protect, restore, and enhance the waters of the lakes, yes. But it's also to look at the existing conditions to see if we can improve or mitigate, for example, if there are failing septic systems in the area. That will be ongoing work where we're going to try and establish standards and policies.
In the old draft, if we didn't show it as a planned community, we couldn't then direct resources to improve infrastructure. And so now we're saying, well, yes, we want to improve infrastructure, but it's going to be unique from other communities because we have water quality issues that are special.
Well, it will be a sub-area of the planned community zone. So the abilities we have in the planned community zone will still hold true for this sub-area, because it will still be planned community zone, because it still reaches the density that colored it in that manner. But it will be a sub-area. With special constraints.
I'd like to still say that I think we should consider having it as a separate zone altogether. So we have the original three, the protection, conservation, and
planning. Can't hear the question.
I was just saying, Debbie, that I think that we may want to consider having that as a fourth district, you know, the conservation, protection, planned communities, and lake communities might make the plan reads more efficiently.
Well, as I proceed through the issues today, I think you'll see that there will be other sub-areas within the planned community zone that get, again, to capacity issues. But that's something we can certainly consider.
Other comments on lake communities?
Are we still maintaining two different colors, if you will, between planning and preservation? Because right now there's really six colors, not just three.
Right.
So are we still maintaining that structure, or is this, are we scrapping that all together?
We're not scrapping it, in that there will still be three zones that will be treated differently in preservation and planning area. How they'll be colored or named
is to be resolved.
Okay. All right, let's move on to the next one.
The next one is existing areas served data. We, again, in the comments we've received, we did receive from some municipalities some more information on pipes in the ground. And so we readily admit that there are data gaps, and that's simply because there is nowhere where you can get a full mapping of pipes in the ground. At the time of the draft plan, it was considered that this information would be updated through the conformance process. What we're telling you now is that where we have that data, we will update it. So we will be using the information we've received from municipalities to add to fill those gaps. And of course, that will be ongoing through conformance, because we'll, together with the towns, we'll be able to map those areas for those that do not yet have them fully mapped. But just to let you know that, again, it's response to comments received. We'll be filling in those data gaps immediately where we have the information.
Does that mean, to the extent that people pointed out errors in the mapping in the draft, that we'll be correcting those at this time, or correcting those subsequently, or omissions?
Well, when you refer, if it's data gaps that have to do with areas, existing areas served, yes, we'll be doing it now. And when it comes to errors, it depends entirely on what we're talking about, and it depends entirely on if they are indeed errors, or if it's a question of if it's a question of opinion or interpretation.
Right, right.
So at this point, I guess all I'm saying to you is that we will be filling in these data gaps.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's also important to remind you all that we're bringing to your attention data sets that are going to be modified or added from the prior data that was used for the original draft of the land use capability map. That means that the other data sets are not going to be updated. For example, there's some land use data that's been modified since that run. It's an enormous amount of effort to incorporate that in the model, probably would prevent us from meeting our deadline. And the significance of several hundred acres of changes we've judged is not a wise use of our time given the schedule. But the purpose of these issues is to let you know these are data sets that we're going to supplement, modify, or change, and that the other ones that were used are not being changed.
I had a question on the recommendations. You mentioned the understanding of significant utility systems. Is there a threshold? Did you come up with, what is significant? Is it a number, a concentration? Are there some that are just two, like three or four houses, and you're going to drop them out?
The way the existing area served mapping was done is if a system is providing sewerage to a single lot or a single project, then it's essentially winds up being a dot on a map. The service areas were for multi-property systems, and we established a cutoff at, I think, about 20,000 gallons per day. Below that, it's tiny. So we try to get as much good information as we can. We know perfectly well that at the very small end of this, we did not have good mapping of existing areas served. So that's something that will have to come out in conformance process because the data are simply not available. But in one case, we had an entire section of a significant, you know, a municipal sewer system that was missing from the map. And so clearly we had to add that back.
Thank you.
So two questions. So this is pipes in the ground. This is not planned sewer service areas, right?
It's pipes in the ground.
It sticks to our original definition.
Yes.
And then just on Mr. Siemens' comment just now, can you just give us some sense about where those suggested data changes were? I mean, you're saying you basically made a decision to include this data set to build the work program there. Were there other comments, other suggestions, other places we identified that might influence the map that are on scale? I'm trying to get a scope of a sense of how much suggestions were out there about what was missed. Were there hundreds of acres, which I would agree with was, you know, minimal change and things, potentially thousands of acres of information that wasn't.
My reading of the comments and conversations with staff indicates that there were some disagreements about certain things, but that the data sets were largely, given the date that the data was assembled and given its geographic and substantive character, was reliable and acceptable. And the update on the land use mapping just we judge to be not worth the effort at this point, though it will at some point be inputted into the tool of the lands model.
Okay. And it was hundreds, not thousands.
Well, that's fine. And I guess, sort of in the thought of public information, if we're anticipating that we're going to see thousands of acres of shifting in these classifications based on this, then we should anticipate that, if only for information's sake. But if it's marginal and you think that the sets were as good as they're going to get in real time, then it's fine.
Well, Councilman, I would just observe as someone who has the opportunity to look at this from the outside, and at a prior meeting, I did make a statement that we anticipate that the resulting map is going to change because of the shift to actual digital data as opposed to the raster mapping. And the scope of that, we think, is going to be relatively modest. I've heard an estimate of perhaps 5 to 10%, but no more. But I have not personally seen the run that has been done. There is a difference. And when the data sets are modified, inputted, and the final model is run, I think you can anticipate that there will be some changes in the maps that we have on the walls.
Other comments? Okay.
Okay, moving on to enhanced growth capacity of developed lands. And this is sort of a continuation of the discussion on the planned community or specially planned areas, planned community zones. Again, the many commenters commented on the fact that the purple areas were not all appropriate for growth, that there were other limiting factors. Obviously, there are constrained lands within them. We know that, and they will be have the ability to map those, and they are regulated, many of those constrained lands. But also was the question of, well, where are the areas that are appropriate for growth? Where there is potential, should again, because again, the growth aspects are discretionary. But again, if a land use capability map should show you where indeed there are areas that are appropriate where capacity does exist. Also, this was important for TDR receiving areas. If we are to have these areas and delineate them, then we have to know that the capacity is potentially there for those growth areas. Staff in both the planning, science, and GIS have all been involved in this exercise in figuring out a way that we can again refine the planned community zones, especially planned areas, to have sub-areas where we can show areas that are appropriate for growth and that have that potential. We used MOD4 data, which is the tax data, in order to do this, and chose certain indicators that would assist us in being able to map those areas. The indicators used are in the memo to you. They are the partially vacant indicator, economically underutilized indicator, vacant indicator, multimodal transit indicator, and local conditions indicator. these indicators allowed for us to look to see where potential exists, where perhaps there's infill development possibilities or redevelopment possibilities that would allow you to better utilize those areas where impervious cover already exists in these developed areas, so that there's potential for growth and possibly potential for TDR receiving areas. You'll also see in this that the results then give us two tiers. Tier number one would give you the census blocks that have a higher number of parcels that are characterized as economically underutilized, unconstrained vacant, have that potential for either infill or refill, and are located in communities with access to multimodal transit connection. Local initiatives would suggest that there's development or redevelopment potential in those areas. That's the tier one result. Tier two were those census blocks that showed some indication of potential, but perhaps not as much as those tier one. Now, we'll be able to, again, map these so that when you look at the planned community zones where you know that there's already an existing density, existing development on those lands, you'll be able to see into them again, and you'll have those lake communities, as we spoke of earlier, and you'll see these tiers as well, so that you'll see that some areas aren't being designated or certainly pointed to as possibly appropriate for growth where these areas are. So it gives us the opportunity to and to work with communities as well to see if they want to consider their options in these particular areas. We think that not only is it good for the plan and for a capability map, it's also a tool for these communities to have a closer look at the information we'll be able to share with them to consider their own potential into the future.
How does the term economically underutilized get defined? Is that a reflection of a local redevelopment initiative? Or just, it obviously has close association with even the main debate that's going on.
And along that line, could somebody elaborate on what the local conditions indicator really is?
The economic utilization indicator is based on the relative value of the improvements versus the land, and a mathematical ratio less than 33% the improvements and less than 50% of the two different criteria that have been used to sort all parcels according to their utility.
And that's drawn from the Mod 4 other data. That's not a determination we're making, I guess.
No, it's just a mathematical calculation from the Mod 4 data.
Okay. Which means it's based on land cover. Is that correct?
Not necessarily. No, it's based on the value of the improvements, regardless of their size, related to the value of the land itself.
And what about Debbie's question about the local indicators?
On the local indicators, basically that's where we have information, again, through the Mod 4 data that shows us that there have been, at the local level, that there have been decisions made and for potential redevelopment, such as redevelopment initiatives, urban enterprise zones, foreign trade zones, and develop portions of state-designated centres. So we already know that there are initiatives at the local level. So there has been already an interest in these kind of opportunities.
Well, where does the resource protection standards play into this? I'm confused on how it seems like only these factors.
Well, because what we're doing is we're taking a sort of a deeper look at the areas where there's already established pattern of development, where there's already impervious cover. So it's an opportunity to make better use of a development pattern that already exists or of a footprint that already exists. So it's rather than sprawling outward into to the outlying environs, what you're doing is you're focusing back in where there's already a development pattern and better utilizing those areas to have redevelopment and infill opportunities.
But what if these areas are within know, in proximity to streams or there's wetlands on the property. I still don't see how this intersects with resource protection.
There was, in this, while they were doing this exercise, they were removing areas where there were constraints already. So when they were looking at, for example, vacant lands, they didn't include constrained lands in the analysis. So that was part of the exercise. And I will tell you as well that, that as the staff have been working on this, there are situations where there is already development in constrained areas. And there's going to be an effort moving forward to have standards where you can have mitigation in those areas and work with communities to look at their opportunities at the same time as looking at their opportunities to mitigate what has already occurred. And so you can, for example, in one community we've been talking to, look at the possibility of greenways along their stream corridor where they could remove invasive species. And then they could look at cleaning up the area. And, you know, in return, we're working with them in other areas. So we provide advice on both sides of it. So redevelopment opportunities and mitigation opportunities.
One of the reasons for the question is that some members of our public were very concerned that these the purple areas contained areas that should be, that have environmental constraints. So we're saying that those theoretically have been eliminated now?
They've been eliminated from the two indicators of vacant land, environmentally sensitive lands. But I believe that the primary program for those sensitive lands within what have been designated as planned community areas will be program standards. For the nature, character, and of development and required mitigation.
Okay, which is what the plan was all along. I was trying to determine if this was, if there's a change, you know, so it could be responsive to those concerns. So that's as it existed in the first draft. Right.
I would describe this as a refinement. One of the comments that we heard a lot was that the purple was too broad a brush. It did not. It portrayed the potential for more development than I think is possible and didn't provide adequate guidance for municipalities going forward. And so it's that area is being refined and not changed.
But Charlie, our answer to that at the time was that those concerns would be addressed through the specific resource protection standards that would be in place, that those concerns were valid, but that was the explanation. Again, I'm trying to determine, has anything really changed? From what I'm hearing, I don't think so. I'm not saying it's bad, and if there's refinements, that's great. But this is not a sea change from where we were.
It is not a sea change, but I do believe that the lack of discrimination in the existing maps has not been a positive for this initiative.
And that's where the difference from the raster to the GIS.
And. Additional ability to manipulate the data mm-hmm. that we did not have before.
I
think as we go through this, I mean, one of the challenges we'll have in considering this and in explaining to the public, and the public will have in reading it, is that if you take an individual policy in isolation, you can't take an individual policy in isolation, even though we have to consider them as we go through it, and that if I understand this correctly, we're going to get to a point where in order to develop a site, one requirement will be that we've identified redevelopment potential, but that will be necessary but not necessarily sufficient to say that that site is suitable for redevelopment. But if you just read that paragraph plan, it may be different. And that's, you know, that's a challenge you will face. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, however, since we are aggregating these five indicators and then ranking them into Tier 1 or Tier 2, correct me if I'm wrong, what we're doing then is we're saying if you fall into the Tier 1, then that block may be appropriate as a TDR, voluntary receiving zone. So those areas that are identified through these five indicators are pretty much being slated for chock-a-block development. You know, that's my concern, is that I hear what you're saying, that there will, you've removed out, for instance, an area that might be environmentally sensitive from being in the vacant indicator. However, you know, the quality of life in a built-up area is enhanced by gardens and trees, and so there may be, you know, brownfields to greenfields. There may be areas that that need to be vacant or open or economically underutilized in order to maintain community character or to improve quality of life for that town. So my concern, I raised this on a call, but my concern is that since these are going to be a further refinement and then they're going to then be put into a tier one, it makes it almost inevitable that they're going to be where the TDR receiving zone credits are going to go. So they're all going to be developed. And how are we going to make sure that we don't do that, that we don't, you know, fill in every little chink?
I think what you have to look at here is the fact that we were mandated to have a land use capability map. And as such, we have to show where there is capability, where development or redevelopment can occur and can be sustained. What we're doing here is showing areas that, according to the data that we have, are potential areas to look at for this. Now, much more study has to be done. So, for example, if we're talking about a TDR receiving area, there are mandates within the TDR bill that clearly, and mandates that we would have in our TDR program, that clearly look for far more work to be done before an area is actually appropriate and considered ready as a TDR receiving zone. So, and it goes not just the sustainability of that, but it goes to mixed use, it goes to character of the community, it goes to recreational and open space. Looking at all of these in one area to make sure, looking at the infrastructure to see if they can support it. So all of these issues aren't lost in this. All this is saying, here's an area that does need a closer look. It also takes off, because the concern was, again, are these planned community zones, are you saying they are all appropriate for growth? And the answer is no. We're saying that a certain development pattern exists there. Now we're refining that to show, here are areas which the information we have at our hands shows us that there is possible or potential for redevelopment in these areas. Now, again, on top of that, this goes back to conformance and to working with these communities. All growth is discretionary. Again, you're saying to the communities, they have to make some of the choices in this as well. But here are where we see the opportunities. So now they have a clearer definition. In a sense, people were saying that all of the purple areas were appropriate for growth. We're saying no, we're refining that information now and focusing you on these areas. There's an awful lot of more planning that has to occur before the decisions are made on what that growth is and what indeed that capacity is.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, and I just would like to put on the table for us to think about what is our position on eminent domain for smart growth. And maybe we should have a policy as a council, and not today, but something to think about. Because I think, you know, the concern that I have is we're building a juggernaut, and I can see where this could very easily end up then being a mandate, even though we're saying it's, you know, there's local decisions to be made, and it's discretionary. I think we just have to build some safeguards in here, and perhaps having a policy that is protective would help that.
I would think for us to support eminent domain or include that as an implementation strategy would contradict what we've repeatedly said throughout this process.
Yes, but I think if we spell it out and say we do not support eminent domain for smart growth as a policy, it would go a long way to explaining our position that growth is discretionary. I just think it's a hot button issue.
Right. We needed another controversial issue.
but if we can't, it's sort of an elephant in the
room. Yeah. I'd just like to say that I think that there's a certain amount of discretion that we've got to allow to the local communities if we want them to buy into our plan. And we can be of service to them by providing some planning guidance if they choose to do some redevelopment and encourage them to provide some open space and recreation and things like that. But I think that the communities themselves will take the right steps too if they're going to enter into a program like that to do the right thing.
If I may follow up on Tracy's point, I think part of what I heard you say is we can't lose the sight of the fact that we're all here to enact a law that its primary goal is resource protection. And there's two components to that. One of it is what we actually do, that we correctly identify areas appropriate for growth and those that aren't. But the other thing to keep in mind, too, is if we don't get it right, and we're talking about planning areas, we want towns to conform. And if we've inappropriately or incompletely or whatever have not identified these areas, it will diminish the probability of conformance in some towns. So that's just something else for us to keep in mind.
Thank you, Debbie.
Yeah, I just have a question. This harks back on the smart growth being discretionary. And I guess my question is very basic. With regards to these five indicators, how are they weighed? And say they're combined on the aggregate, but how are they being weighed?
They're being included and aggregated, and then in a sense, it's not so much they're being weighed as the presence of them would dictate whether they go into tier one or tier two. If all of them are present, then they're more likely to be in the tier one. If there's less of an area of them and some of them are not as present as others, then they go into the second rank, so that there'd be less opportunity in those areas. But I'm not sure we've actually weighted any one of them over the other. I think at the moment they're just all included.
If I recall, there is a, if you're very close to a transit station, it's a bit more of an emphasis than if you're slightly farther away from a transit station. So there is that bit of weighting. It's a distance weighting, if you will. But between them, it's very hard to decide that one is more important than the other. It's more a matter of overlapping, and we find this true on the development side and on the environmental resources side. It's very hard to decide that one is half as important as the other. It's more a matter of do you have reinforcing patterns, and that's what we look for.
Okay, moving on to regional transportation system and our meeting with the Department of Transportation and New Jersey Transit. We've covered many of these items with them and went over this with them to, again, just to make sure that we're coordinating with our partner agencies. This, again, is also responsive to comments received, both from those state agencies and from members of the public and, indeed, members of the council, as to including transportation as, again, to inform and refine those planned community areas. So we look at the transportation corridors, and including developed lands within a quarter mile of significant U.S. routes, state routes, and specified county routes. And the U.S. routes, just to note that Interstate Routes 78, 287, 80 and 280 are limited access highways and therefore were treated differently and excluded from this particular portion of the analysis. The routes included were U.S. routes, including routes 46, 206, 202, and 22, state routes, including routes 24, 94, 31, 12, 173, 15, 10, and 57, and county roadways, including 510, 511, 512, 513, 517 and 519. We also included here interchanges and intersections. These are developed lands within a half a mile of buffered roadway interchanges and intersections. And they include interstate or interchanges or interstate routes 80, 287, 78, and 280. U.S. routes, those that intersect with other U.S. routes, state routes, and county routes. State routes that intersect with other state routes and county routes, and county routes that intersect with other identified county routes. The next indicator were train station, and we used two areas here. We used an inner core and an outer core. The inner core was developed and undeveloped lands within a half of mile, which is the inner core, buffer of train stations, or within a half mile of the Highlands region. New Jersey Transit rail stations in the Highlands region were considered included the Boonton Line, Main Line, and Burton County Line, Morris and Essex Line, and Raritan Valley Line. The train station outer core includes developed and undeveloped lands within a mile buffer of train stations or within 1 mile of the Highlands region. And again, they include the same New Jersey Transit rail stations that I mentioned above. We included park and rides, all developed lands within a half mile buffer from all park and ride locations in or within a half mile of the Highlands region. And we also did, the planning staff were involved in the collection of information on bus routes. This included all NJ Transit and major private bus carriers in the Highlands region, which operate daily on a daily basis on any of the US state or county routes used in the analysis. The presence of a bus route indicates the potential for transit opportunity, and private bus providers were contacted by the staff in order to verify the presence of existing routes, including the following: community coach, short line bus, Lakeland bus lines, and trans bridge lines. This is a further analysis that will again inform and refine planned community zones. And again, like everything else that has come before, is in response to comments received on the draft plan.
I mean, are you going to try and identify where, for example, on bus routes, where the buses stop? You know, a lot of them stop in places other than park and rides.
Right. Now, and it's funny that you mentioned that, because Chris Stannis has been doing the work on this, specifically spoke to that. And I'll ask Chris to respond to it.
Chris, can you come near our microphone so people on phone?
It's a good question regarding the bus stops. Bus stops in this analysis were evaluated as a secondary effect. Bus stops are things that municipalities can choose to site on their own and locate on their own, and they can be flexible. We did not use bus stops at this point in time, but we have collected the data on them and intend to use that in the next step with conformance with municipalities and counties. So the bus stops are flexible, and it's the routes that are really the regional driver for where that bus goes, travels to and from.
And if you look at Route 46, it's just one of the routes identified on here. Strong all along there, all the way into the city are bus stops, and thousands of people get on those buses just from bus stops, not from park and rides. And any one of those places, if we're looking at potential areas to redevelop, being near one of those bus stops would be appropriate.
We're also looking at the ridership studies for rail and bus throughout the region to look at just things, just as you point out. Who's getting on the bus? What are the numbers of those? What are the occupancy rates of the park and rides that are along there? And using that to further enhance this.
Thanks, Chris.
What about recommendations for improved transportation infrastructure? Added routes, added stations. You know, my concern is that we basically have a system right now that takes you in and out of New York City and doesn't do a lot more than that unless you just happen to have the right stops at the right place. And I know that transit has, you know, we're building the Howard Boulevard station in Roxbury, Lackawanna Cutoff, extension of Raritan Valley into Phillipsburg, Roll. Good, valid projects, but what's next, and how does it help reduce traffic congestion in the Highlands, help people get from one place to another, maybe even within the Highlands, without having to get in a motor vehicle? How does it help achieve the governor's new directive to reduce pollutants by whatever year he's directed it by? You know, if the goal is to get people out of cars, we've got to do we have to improve our system. Am I concern all along has been that, you know, we keep analyzing what's in place. Through the analysis, we may justify where it's appropriate to develop. But what about existing development with no transportation infrastructure? You know, what about providing infrastructure into those areas so that we can reduce congestion on roads, not have to add more lanes on the certain highways, reduce the time that it takes people who don't have transportation options to drive to and from work, thereby cutting down pollutants. You know, we've got a freight spur that jumps off of the Morris line above Dover and goes through Suksana into Flanders. You know, should we be considering and recommending, you know, that be turned into a passenger train line, you know, that could express people into Dover to switch to a high speed into downtown. You know, Flanders has a huge concentrated area of people, Suksana, huge concentration of people. And then there's even, you know, right, the line goes right through the middle of Ledgewood and Roxbury Malls. I really would like to see us do something more than just study and say, well, here it is.
And I take your point, Kurt, and I agree that we have a lot more work to do, and I will tell you that those conversations are, I don't want to say starting, they're ongoing with Transit and with DOT. They were part of our conversation a week ago when we met with them. However, I think the first step is that from the comments received that we have to have a place for this within our mapping system that again lends to directs where growth is appropriate and where we already have some of these on the ground. So the first step was to actually get these into the land use capability map. And like you mentioned, Howard Boulevard, that was missed last time. It's a train station under construction. That is picked up in the new, and it will be put into the new the lands model. And so I think the first step is to see where the existing are and then to make recommendations. And that will be ongoing work. But for purposes of today, I think that what we're showing again is progress and response to comments in that we're taking the next steps, which is to show where they are and how they should influence the capability map and the future of the area. But then there's a lot more work to do then on recommendations. I know the staff also have done a lot of work on the numbers as regards internal traffic, so what the journeys that start within the Highlands and end within the Highlands, they've got the analysis of that, and journeys that are through the state. So and through the Highlands. So we, and that information will assist us in working with Transit and DOT on an analysis of how best then to, you know, make our recommendations and the effect of those recommendations, knowing that analysis.
So Eileen, you're saying that draft 2 of the regional master plan will include recommendations for expanding infrastructure and thereby inducing growth in these areas?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that further work has to be done in that area. I'm saying for the purposes of this next generation, what the staff is proposing today is what will be done. These are conversations that will continue to be held with municipalities and with our sister agencies. But I'm not saying that will be in this current draft.
Okay, so direct question. Will it be in this plan, yes or no? Not what question?
I'm loath to say no, but I mean, I will defer to Charlie and to others on the team, but certainly no commitment at this point in time. If there was something that we wanted to bring to your attention, a recommendation that that staff had analysed to the level that we felt that we were convinced that we could bring it to you, we would bring it to you. But absent that, at this point, no.
Yeah, no is suggesting that there will not be any specific recommendations in this draft in terms of new transportation infrastructure. Is that the question that you're answering for Debbie?
That's what I was answering, yes.
Okay.
And what you're saying, Kurt, is it would be good if there were.
I think there's such obvious things. Yeah. Just take, for instance, Morristown. You know, every train in and out should have a bus that is at the train station to bring people through Morristown, drop them off the courthouse, the square, Century 21 department store, you know, all the different residential regions, and it loops around and picks up people to bring back to the train station. It just defies all common sense that we dump people in Morristown, the county seat, and they got to, you know, walk 10 blocks to go to the courthouse. I mean, there should be a bus there, timed with the trains. And you go to any other Western European country, bang, you get anywhere. And here it's pathetic, you know, and I know it's one of these things with transit. Well, if we build a station, will they come? You know, we don't have the ridership, so we can't justify the money. And we invest tremendous billions of dollars into road infrastructure, but we're not willing to invest into transportation infrastructure other than roads. And I'm a firm believer if we build it and it's and it's convenient, they will use it. And it fits in, you know, less impervious coverage. You can't park at Morristown Station. There's not enough parking. Well, people can get picked up a block from their home, take the bus in to get on the train to zip into downtown. They won't park. So then there's less impervious coverage because we don't need another parking lot or a parking garage. That's my thinking. And I think this keeps getting shuffled to the side. And I think that these are very important issues from a planning perspective for the region.
Well, I think it's
for the state.
I think it's important, and I think the question is how we do that, because we would all like to see, I think, more mass transit that did not induce inappropriate development. And the question is whether we can frame proposals in that direction before we have a plan, or whether we end up with a plan that basically has that as an implementation strategy that says something to that effect of that's what we want to do, that we want to move that to be more specific and to get more specific proposals, but that we're not going to have them. I think what Eileen's saying is, at this point, the plan is not to have those by November or January. Debbie, what were you saying?
Yeah, John, and I just want to add that some of us are aware of the intent of state planning agencies, transportation planning agencies, DOT, et cetera, that some individuals a desire for us to incorporate their transportation infrastructure expansion plan. They just simply want us to build that into our plan. And for those of us who, unfortunately, Kurt, I can't agree with you on a lot of these, and I'm involved with the planning at the county level in Warren County, they're very controversial issues, very questionable whether there were significant benefits. Sounds great in theory. Many of us are concerned about what we know is a certainty. With certainty, they will be growth-inducing. It's whether the benefits. So I certainly would not want to see us incorporating those plans simply because they're out there and we've been asked to coordinate and be consistent with other agencies.
If I could add one piece of information that we do have is that there is a study starting up. It's called the Northwest New Jersey Study. It is aimed at the intra-region transit needs as opposed to the New York City and back transit needs. My understanding is that it's a fairly sizable chunk of money that's being put into this. The Highlands Council staff has been offered a seat at the table to be involved.
Who is doing this? Is DOT doing this? Or who?
This is through TPA or transit?
It's New Jersey Transit federal funding that's being monitored by NJTPA. The RFP is coming out in November. It's $900,000 to $1 million to study portions of Mars, Warren, and Sussex for interrelated bus enhancement.
What is NJTPA?
North Jersey Transportation Planning Agency.
It's the authority.
It's the regional transportation planning.
This was brought up at our meeting with DOT and Transit, and we did express a desire to be included in that, and as Chris said, have a seat at the table, and we're very much welcomed by them. And so they told us we absolutely would be. But it goes to, I think, really answering Kirk and Debbie in saying we want to make sure that we've done the correct analysis and are able to deliver to you the correct information so that you can make your decisions on recommendations or policies moving forward. And unless something changes in the meantime, we haven't got that information today.
And Eileen, just to add specifically on page 4, I guess we're on, or at least on my copy, it's page 4, under recommendations, it says the word, recommend the identification of regional and multimodal opportunities. One of the reasons why I asked the question, when we rewrite the plan, if we are limiting this to existing, we need to make that clear that we're talking about existing and not potential new opportunities.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I think that the plan should make note of the fact that what Kurt has said is that we recognize the need to try to identify opportunities to improve our transportation networks. I mean, I see poor kids in college, trying to find mass transit, and they've tried several times to, for example, get mass transit to the county college in Morris, and they've all kind of failed for one reason or another.
Mr. Chairman.
We have to look at these things because they keep providing more parking places at the county college, and that's crazy.
John, if you could indulge me one moment here, just clarification maybe for some of you in more urban areas may not understand where those out in the hinterlands what we're concerned about. There are discussions with support from some of these agencies to create transit villages in the middle of farmland where there is no existing centers of anything to speak of, and that's why it's such an issue out here.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I certainly contemplate, our consultant team contemplates that there will be a significant enhancement of the goals, policies, and objectives element of this plan with regard to future mobility in the region, which we regard as critical to the long-term integrity of the region. Where I think it will, where the future is in the programs, we can identify programs, but we can't identify projects, I don't believe, in this time frame. But I think you'll see.
What do you mean by programs in that context?
Provide local intermodal transportation to avoid future growth-inducing road construction, for example. And so I believe that where we are today in the draft document and where we'll be and what we present, consultant team delivers to you, will be won't be all the way to a specific project like a particular cutoff or something, but it will be, I think, very directive in terms of future goals, policies, and objectives and how those ought to be programmatically pursued by all agencies of government who are involved.
Move on to the next topic.
Okay. Now that we've done with the difficult ones, we can go to the easy ones.
Right. Let me, while you're, the minutes now have been available on the back table for a while, so if you're in public and you didn't get a copy of them, they're there if you want them.
Okay. The next issue is that we're bringing to you today is water availability. And again, this is just to show you the progress we've made and, again, response to comments received. The subsequent to the release of the draft plan, and the DEP has developed policies for the next New Jersey statewide water supply plan and has proposed major changes to the water quality management planning rules. In their statewide water supply plan, they're using the same technical approach as used by the Council for the Draft RMP, which is the low flow margin method, the calculation of consumptive and depletive uses, and the use of eco-flow goals approach to provide a basis for certain thresholds. We also received public comments on some of the aspects of the policies, and this has provided us again with valuable insights so that we can again respond and bring this back to the Council for your consideration. The recommended changes aren't major ones. They really refine the approach that was laid forth in the draft regional master plan. What we're looking at doing is, rather than focusing on the zones within sub-watersheds, we're looking at assigning water availability thresholds to the entire HUC 14 sub-watersheds. And what we'll do is we're doing that based on the dominant zone. So if it's greater than 75% of the watershed, it goes to that HUC 14. Or failing that, we look at the watershed condition indicator. We're cross-referencing the NJDEP rules protecting water supply safe yields from new consumptive and depletive water uses and reducing water availability thresholds in upstream HUC 14 sub-watersheds by 2 to 3% low-flow margin to a minimum of 5% low-flow margin. And this addressed the impacts of new water uses that DEP does not regulate. We're providing limited conditional water availability in deficit sub-watersheds. This was a concern raised. Where we have deficit sub-watersheds, how do we handle it? Well, if we give them some limited conditional availability, that's counted then because of the protect, restore, and enhance. We're having conditioning that upon 125% mitigation, which is exactly what was in
the draft RMP. For HUC 14 subwatersheds that are upstream of deficit subwatersheds, changing the policy from a fixed 5% low flow margin, which resulted in additional deficit subwatersheds, to a policy of 5% low flow margin above current consumptive and depleted water uses, but not above standard thresholds. And finally, the distribution of available water within a HUC 14 subwatershed on the basis of the regional master plan's development and redevelopment potential. And we did provide for you a matrix, which is similar to the one that's in the draft RMP. And in talking with some of you, in particular Tracy, we've looked at the changes that I showed you. It's very similar to what you had in your draft regional plan, but is refined based on the comments and on working more closely with DEP.
I have a comment. The current overlay that shows water availability, I had a problem with because it showed a deficit area but poor water availability, and yet these two areas were all served by the same water system. It's because, and our problem is we don't know where all those pipes in the ground are that are feeding all of these other areas, and somehow we've got to get a hold of that information. I'm not sure how to do it. But, if we're showing water availability here in an area where the system is primarily showing a deficit, it's a problem. And the problem is these things cross municipal lines also.
Yeah.
So it's very complicated to get to the bottom of that.
It is extremely complex.
It's going to make a big difference. I mean, just because, like, Lineville looks like they are okay from looking at these low flow margins and stuff, they get their water all from another town.
Yeah.
And so,
We've been grappling with this, and we had a meeting with the DEP again in the last couple of weeks, and talked with them, and what they've set forth their thresholds, and what they've said is if there's more detailed information available, then they would look to to use that, utilize that information. Certainly in the case of what we're proposing in the Highlands, they've agreed that the approach is scientifically, it has a firm basis in science, and they've said that they will utilize what we're doing here, and they've sent us actually a follow-up email to further say that they understood the basis for the decisions and understand the analysis that went into that decision making. So we're feeling we've again made a great deal of progress on this issue, and there's further work to be done, into the future of water tracking models and things of that nature, and that Dan has already laid forth for the future. But we have the ability to do this right now and to set these thresholds so that we can work with these communities planning to understand what's available and how to mitigate where they have deficits.
I think that our plan should reflect the fact that we know there is this lack of information available right now. I mean, if we start identifying planned areas and saying it looks like they have enough water because we just don't have the data,
I think it's important to recognize that this is the first step in a fairly lengthy equation. The first question is, does the sub-watershed have available water? And that's based on what's withdrawn from it, what's used of that water, and what comes back to that sub-watershed. That's pretty much irrespective of any other lines coming in and out. We have situations where water comes from an outside sub-watershed, is brought into another sub-watershed, is used, and is taken back out in sewer systems. Well, it's as if that water never touched the sub-watershed, but it definitely supports development within it. We do, in fact, have the existing area served for all of the major water supply systems in the Highlands. And we have the existing area served for all of the major sewer systems in the Highlands. And part of what we're after with the land swap, which we were not able to do last year, very important, is to be able to go from where does the water come from to what utility is transporting it, to where is it used, to what wastewater system then collects that wastewater
and do they have capacity?
Is so that
if you, yes. If you think about it, you need to support any sort of development, you need first access to the resource. Second, a water utility that is capable of handling it. Third, a wastewater utility that is capable of handling the results. And fourth, a discharge location that's capable of handling the discharge. And if you don't have all of those, you don't have growth. That's, if you think about it, that's the ideal ability that we're looking for. We have the ability to do that up to a certain level in this iteration of the plan, the next generation plan. And we already know how we want, we'll get to the next step where we'll be able to refine that.
Other comments on what
we're doing? I have a question.
Kurt, go ahead.
Okay. How do we plan to handle a situation where, again, we have a deficit, water sub... What's the word I'm looking for?
Sub-watershed.
Thank you. And half of it's being, you know, pulled out and extracted and sent to one of the areas of northeastern New Jersey. Yet there's a viable town center in there that, in every other planning respect, supports a logical place for additional growth. And how do we handle that? Are we going to tell that? Are we going to make a judgment call that says, well, okay, it's still suitable for growth, but we need to import the water from someplace else through a system, and that's okay? Or are we going to say, nope, we're not doing any more growth there, even though the water for themselves was never overutilized, but because so much of it is being taken out and sent someplace else, that all of a sudden this little town center finds itself with no options where it might be a perfect place for some future development?
Let me split that into two different types of questions. First of all, the safe yield for the reservoirs that are going outside to the northeastern part of the state do not reflect on groundwater capacity or water availability in the Highlands at all. They are separate. Those reservoirs exist based on an existing safe yield that's been certified by the department, and they can take half of that water out or all of that water out, and it does not change the net water availability within the Highlands. So the two have to be separated. So if there's a deficit shown in any of these sub-watersheds, it's because of the demand on groundwater within that sub-watershed, or on surface water that's not associated with the reservoir. Somebody just has a pump in the river, they have no storage, and they're pulling water from the river. So we try to make this whole system so that the deficits you see in the maps are very much a matter of what's happening in the Highlands and not related to the use of water outside the Highlands.
But since Morris County is almost all in the Highlands and all of its water pump is groundwater essentially, the reservoirs are feeding Jersey City.
That's correct. And so the net water availability is based on the groundwater use in the Highlands of the groundwater from the Highlands. And we try very hard to separate those two pieces because of this very issue.
Well, then, I don't know if you're at this point yet, but is there a recommendation of how Kurt's situation would be handled if you have a village that's...
I can't hear you, John.
If you have a village that could otherwise accommodate some added development except but for the absence of additional water supply.
Then the question is whether there is an alternative water supply or a way of reducing consumptive and depleted water demand within that same subwater shed so that it offset the new demands. And the answer in some cases might be yes, and in other cases it might be no. And that's, once we get to the point where we have some sense of the development capacity of the planned community zones, which is another thing that we didn't have last year, then we will be able to tell whether we have a problem. And that's the first question. If there's no problem, then there's no problem. If there is a problem, then the second question is, can we do anything about that problem without causing a problem somewhere else?
Right.
And it would be yes or no.
Okay. Tracy?
Yes, a couple of questions. On the recommendations, the number one, where the dominant zone is how the water is going to be assigned, the availability of water is going to be assigned. Is it fair to say that that then is going to allow more water for conservation zone development?
given the nature of the highlands, what you find is that most of the sub-watersheds that have a dominant zone, the dominant zone is the protection zone.
Okay.
And we had odd situations where water, you have, you know, you could have 80%, 90% protection zone and 10% planned community zone. And you get, it shifted the water availability. And yet that planned community zone wasn't actually getting its water from that sub-watershed at all. Mm-hmm. And so it was, I don't know, was a good word, it was sort of twisting the results that we were getting and giving us net water availability for the wrong zone. You want the net water availability to be attached to where it's actually going to be used.
You almost have to look at it like on a case-by-case basis.
Well, we've tried to actually, out of the 183 sub-watersheds, 100 of them have 75% or more in a dominant zone. And it was only the last chunk that we had to divide up based on the attributes of the watershed itself. So we're making progress on that. I don't think we're quite to the end of it, but we're making progress on that.
But in terms of the former approach, which was making the water available based on the zone, mm-hmm. It was limited amount of water that was going to be available in the conservation zone and the protection zone.
Right.
And this is going to allow more water to be available in the conservation zone, isn't it? I mean, especially if we're going to allow transfer from one sub-watershed to another.
First of all, with regard to conservation zone and protection zone development, the number of times where you would have a transfer is going to be extremely small, because anytime you have a public water or sewer system, it's generally gravity driven in terms of the sewer system, and so it's contained within the sub-watershed. Have very few developed areas in those zones that would involve an interbasin transfer, an interwatershed transfer. So that's part of it. But the other part of it is, and again, I don't have the numbers yet, so it's a little hard to tell. But in many cases, the protection zone sub-watersheds under this method will wind up with a slightly reduced water availability, not an increase in water.
Okay, and then just one last question on this. I have other questions too, but then were there areas that had infrastructure capacity for sewer and not infrastructure capacity for water in the conservation zone, for instance? And this relates to our planning for clustering and the policy that we made, policy decision that we made, that clustering in the conservation zone would only be allowed in and adjacent to existing infrastructure. So what will be the impact of this switch here on that? Will it make more of those cluster developments possible because now water is available where it wasn't before?
That gets into the distinction, not by the HUC 14 watershed, but the issue of the suggested change for the conservation zone. I think in the conservation zone, the proposal that we have here is that it would both increase and fix, protect, if you will, the availability of water for agriculture, and it would, to a certain extent, limit the amount of water that would be available for development as a way of protecting agriculture from having all of the water flow over to development, if you will.
And that's because of the standard threshold in the conservation zone.
That's right.
Now, I don't want to dominate, but I did have several things that, just considering what Charlie said, speak now and forever, I just want to get them on the record. I have concern in the conservation zone, the standard threshold was 10. Now it's 5 for non-ag and 10 for ag. So we're basically adding another 5% onto what we were adding before. And I think it's a leap of faith to, unless you're going to tell me that there's been some analysis done, in two ways. One, how do we know that we're not going to be creating a deficit watershed? And I know we have a cap, and that's good. And I know that when there is going to be a depleted use, we're going to require 125% mitigation, and we're going to require that in the conservation zone above the existing depleted and consumptive use. But still, that we're making a guess, aren't we? I mean, how are we going to know that we're, that is safe for the ecosystem? Because what we had talked about all along over the last couple of years is because we don't have the ability to plan based on an EcoFlow model at this point, because we don't have all the data, that we are going to take a very conservative approach. And that's why we ratcheted down so much the percent available above the low flow margin of safety. And now we're adding, in this case, the 5% conservation zone, and we're adding this 1 and 2% above the depletive and consumptive uses. So we're making a leap of faith that those are available, and we have no information here about, no science discussed about how this is going to affect the ecosystems of those streams. So that's my concern. We don't have an EcoFlow model. We're making a decision here that's purely based on politics, if you will, or planning, divorced from what is the impact on the ecosystem? How are the streams going to be affected by this additional 5%, 1%, 2%?
The 1% and 2% I think are easy to answer because they're conditional. And so it's a method of saying we know that it would be relatively easy to have that level of development occur and yet achieve 125% mitigation.
But we haven't done the analysis. I mean, 1%, I mean, how many, it's 250 houses for 2%, say, 125 houses or units for 1%. How do you know how much development is going to happen, and the 125% of that development is going to equal the amount that we're allowing it to be used?
Well, essentially what we're saying in this suggestion is that if you can't achieve the 125%, then you don't get that portion of the 1 or 2%, period.
I understand, but maybe I'm not making myself clear. I don't understand I don't think we have done on a sub-watershed analysis to say that the development at 125% mitigation is going to protect sufficiently from throwing that water sub-watershed into deficit mode or affecting the ecological system of those streams. Or else we'd be using the EcoFlow model. I mean, the 125% is a guess, isn't it? I mean, I know it seems reasonable and doable, but there's no one-for-one guarantee here. And I know you can't have guarantees, but that's why we took a very conservative approach, because we don't have the information to give us guarantees.
I think I follow what you're asking, and the, I don't know, there is a lot more behind this that I was specifically suggested not to write a treatise about, but the technical report will have to be modified, and we will have to have a detailed basis and background for the changes that we're talking about. So I think probably the best thing to do is for us to say, yes, I understand what you're saying at this point.
Fine.
And we recognize that we have to answer it in some fashion.
Thank
Tracy,
you.
I think you have other comments, but let me see if other people do.
I think Debbie has some.
Debbie, did you have some comments?
A question. Actually, first, based on Tracy's comments, Tracy, has the Natural Resources Subcommittee been involved in this recommendation at all?
No.
Basically, we're focusing as a council of the whole for the most part going forward.
Okay. And I just want to ask, I think it was Dan speaking, I have a clarification question. You said something about in this iteration we were able to do something that we weren't able to do a year ago. And, you know, I'm still struggling to understand these Huckford gates in the water availability science. So could you explain to me what was the background to that comment?
We're basically able to, and this is difficult to do regionally, just through a modeling process. But if we have an area where we're concerned about water availability, we have the ability to say, all right, where is the water coming from? Is it causing a problem? Where does the water go to in terms of a water utility? Where does that water go to in terms of a wastewater utility? And then where is that water discharged?
And why weren't we able to do this a year ago. What's changed in the meantime?
A ton of data. A lot of GIS analysis behind that.
Actually, let me cut to the chase to try and save time. Didn't we, part of this is that we contracted for additional analysis from USGS. Is this related to some of those expenditures?
No, that was related primarily to the next topic on the septic system density. The work that I'm talking about is primarily in-house work and work with one of the other consultants.
Okay, and we started that when?
I'm a bit of a loss because I've only been back 5 weeks, over the course of this calendar year.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Just a quick scenario. I'm a former old McDonald. I used to have cows. I decided to reinvigorate my business, put in high-density apple trees. Now I need irrigation. I'm in the Highlands Conservation Zone. I figure I'm going to need to pump more than 100,000 gallons a day during peak irrigation times if there's a drought, which requires a DEP license for water removal or diversion. And I think that there's a 50,000 gallon trigger in the Highlands Act, right? It drops down from 100 to 50. So I happen to be in a subwatershed that's in deficit. What happens to farmer Old McDonald? Does he get his water diversion or does he not?
The DEP has indicated, based on the law, that they will be consistent with the water availability approach. It will basically be incorporated into the statewide water supply plan. So what the Highlands does gets reflected there. And then it's up to them to determine whether or not there is water available and whether it would have a negative effect, a harmful effect, based on their rules. It's the DEP's decision. Well, it's the County Agricultural Agency's decision initially, and then it's DEP's review of that decision. These are exempt uses from the Highlands perspective, and so inevitably it's DEP's call as to whether or not they're going to give that ag certification.
And so, we did bring this up with them at our last meeting.
So our determinations have no bearing on the DEP review of ag diversions?
It has some bearing on their review because of the issue of what is water availability. And they will have the statewide water supply plan. It will, as we understand it, incorporate or by reference incorporate the Highlands plan. And so they will be looking at our threshold values too as part of their determination on water availability.
Because the challenge is going to be is if we're to encourage a viable agricultural industry in this region, it's going to be more intensive, higher value crops, which require irrigation. Not consistently, but 100,000 gallons is only 4 acre inches. So we're not talking about a lot of water relative to what the crop use is. And of course, an inch to an inch and a half of water per week per acre is about what you need for most crops. So it's not an everyday pumping, but you could exceed that threshold on the single day, which is why you need the diversion. Bottom line is, if I know we're getting on the prime soils in a couple, at some point, if we preserve all this farmland and do all these other initiatives to try to keep these guys profitable, or gals profitable, but then say, well, you can do everything except we're not going to let you have water because you're in a deficit sub-watershed, everything else has been for nothing. Because, high-density apple trees with their restrictive rootstocks don't produce in a drought year without water.
Statewide, there is a situation statewide where DEP does in fact look at whether or not there's water available.
Let's get on the water topic somewhere.
Yeah. That is an issue.
I have some concerns about some of the policies in this also. And part of it goes to, I think, what Kurt was saying, that as I read this in the conservation zone, you're talking about increasing the percentage of the low flow that's available from 10% to 15%. And if you're going to protect the 10% for ag, we're basically adding 5% on for development, right? I know it was presented as clarifying sort of how it would be allocated between those two uses. I guess part of my concern is, again, so I can what Tracy said, what's the basis for that other than being responsive to the public comments? I know that when general public saw the analysis on the deficit conditions in this watershed. I know there was a great awakening in terms of what people's perception were in terms of the availability of water in the region. And I guess, so I don't know how well supported that is in terms of our understanding what the potential impacts ought to be or will be as we're making this recommendation to go forward to expand the amount of water taken out of those watersheds in the conservation zone. I guess the second part of that would be, I actually support what Kirk was saying, that I think the preference in the conservation zone should be to be reserving that water for agriculture and not for new development, because that's the general trend of policies. So that's my question on this, is that the direction that these recommendations are taking us? And the second part is, I don't understand the logic. If we have a deficit situation in a watershed, why we would then want to enact a policy that would allow us to start extracting even 1% above the existing depleted and something uses, especially as furthering those deficit conditions. I understand that it's contingent upon this mitigation, which I guess is part of my last question, which is, what is the success record? We use that term very easily, you know, when we run up against potential conflicts either in the planned community development zones or elsewhere. But, you know, what is the record of successfully restoring groundwater resources back into watersheds that are under stress or deficit conditions? I mean, if there's a technical record out there that shows that this has been done successfully, then it becomes a much more logical policy. But I think we ought to think about the idea that sort of strictly maintaining the deficit status will help us go back and look at water conservation and look at more efficient use of it, and that's the way to go at making more supply available, rather than setting a policy that says we recognize we're in deficit, yet we're going to allow to take more on top of the deficit condition.
Other comments from council members?
Couple other questions, and just to follow up on that, because we do have a mandate to restore, mm-hmm. and we're ignoring that by we're basically writing off those deficit areas forever to be deficit and adding on 1 or 2%, unless we are absolutely sure that the 125% mitigation is going to get that watershed out of deficit. So we have a responsibility to restore, and we're ignoring that by doing this. On number four on the recommendations, talking about the current consumptive and depletive water uses, the word current concerns me. Is that at full allocation? Because we had a lot of discussion about that. There's, you know, plenty of current use, and then there's allocated use that's not realized yet. Do you mean fully allocated use, or do you mean the current use?
We mean current. As in the numbers that we have are 2003, and we consider that current for the purposes of the plan. So it is not at full allocation. The department's rules are very clear. If there is a problem that would be caused by full allocation, they have the ability to pull back those allocations. And so we're focused on existing.
When has DEP ever done that? I'm sorry to disappoint you.
Actually, a number of times.
Okay, well, I am all the more concerned then, because we, in the draft plan and in the technical, you know, the technical documents, these huge documents that were produced for the draft plan, we, you know, have quite a discussion in there about why we need to take a very conservative approach. And that's another reason, because there are allocations out there that exceed current use. So if we are already in a depletive and consumptive use already exceeds the low flow margin of safety, and we're not even considering the full allocation, I'm all the more concerned that we're adding 1 to 2% and then this 5% in the conservation zone. And then I have a question based on what Charlie said earlier about there's lots of things here that we're not mentioning, so that means they're staying the same or that we're not changing them. Because there are a lot of policies in the draft plan that we've worked on related to water availability. And, you know, I'm sure you're aware of them. And if it's not discussed, then those are not changing?
My comment was directed towards data sets.
Oh.
So these, there are other policies which are not addressed in this discussion here. Are they going to be affected? You know, how are we going to, are we going to assume that all policies are now changing based on this document and everything not mentioned is out? Just trying to clarify, because there are other issues in the draft plan in terms of policies that we arrived at as a council.
We have a further discussion on goals, policies, and objectives, so there will be further clarification at that point, because, of course, we have to make sure that we're consistent. So there will be more work on that.
Thank you.
Because some of what I'm hearing here from Tim and Tracy in particular is the scientific basis, and Dan did refer to, we did send out some background information. When we've had our staff meetings and discussed all these different things, whether it's threshold policies, whatever, we've discussed it from having a firm scientific basis, a firm legal defensibility basis, and good planning. And what we're asking ourselves, have we met the bar from a science basis, from a legal basis, and from a good planning basis as well? And so, I turn to the professional staff, and we have to give you more information on the technical side of this to show the scientific basis, and we'll be doing that. I will tell you that I did say to Dan, let's limit it to what we can handle today and move it on. But we hear what you're saying, and we'll make sure that where you have numbers, you have the basis.
Thank you.
Do you have 5 minutes, or you have to leave?
5 minutes, yeah.
Okay. But there are a couple of things we need to vote on, so why don't we just do that now, and we can continue the discussion. The minutes from the... our last meeting, we have both the meeting itself and the executive session. So I entertain a motion to approve the minutes. Do you have a second?
I'll second them.
Any comments from council members? Comments from the public? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
I abstain.
And I abstain.
Okay. And so it passes 9 with 2 abstentions. And the minutes on the executive session? A motion to approve
those.
For a second?
I'll second that.
Comments? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstentions?
Stay.
Stay.
Okay. Thank you. And then the one other item which I mentioned at the beginning, one other voting item, is that Debbie has indicated that she would like to no longer serve as treasurer of the council. Or budget chair. We sort of combine those functions, but under our bylaws, we elect the treasurer. Debbie, I don't know if you want to say anything, but I want to thank you for doing this so rarely.
Thank you, John. Now I think it's time for somebody else to enjoy the opportunity to do this work. I will say, and I hope that. Bill Carter will be elected treasurer, and he will agree to accept it. I think he'll be a great choice for treasurer. The only thing I want to express, and this has to do with the future, is I've been very frustrated by the fact that in 2 years we've really not made meaningful progress towards completing an audit of our financial records, and that really needs to change. And while I will no longer be treasurer, I will continue to harp on that from my seat further down the table, and I ask the staff and the council to make sure that gets done post-haste.
Well, thank you for doing it for so long. So I entertain motion nominations for the...
I'll nominate Bill Cogger as treasurer.
Is there a second?
I'll second that.
Okay. We could also consider Liz or Glenn, because they're not here either. but I did speak to Bill, and he would be willing to do that if he was so anointed. Any other nominations? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, thanks. All right, back to the issues. We have gone through mostly through 6 of 15. Thank you, Mimi. Moving to septic density.
Well, septic density shouldn't be, we're going to be coming back to this one. Because as of today, we have certain recommendations to make to you, but we're not ready to discuss thresholds at this point. But what we can deal with is the recommendations that are before you today, so I can lay those out for you. Septic system density is basically a commonly used indicator of environmental and especially water quality impacts within communities. And so it's a useful surrogate of the many types of pollutants that are discharged by properly functioning systems. What we've looked at really is the first issue is in the preservation area we have the DEP rules, and we will be relying on those rules within the preservation area, the septic densities that they've set forth. The methodology has been looked at and examined by us, and we'll be using similar type approaches. The allowable systems, what we're suggesting moving forward is that allowable septic system densities will be tailored to each of the zones in the planning area, which will reflect the impacts of existing nitrate levels and recognise the legislative and regulatory distinction between the preservation and planning areas. So we'll be bringing more information to you, but at this point we are saying that those densities will be tailored to each of those zones. Where nitrate dilution models are used in the plan, the modelling assumptions used by NJDEP, which goes back to my former comment, in its Highlands rules regarding nitrate concentrations and loads will be used by us as well in those models. Recharge by the HUC 14 subwatersheds will be used as the basis for dilution, consistent with other regional plan analyses. But we will tell you that the drought ground water recharge will be used as the conservative factor to address nitrate impacts in smaller watersheds, headwater areas, and aquifers within limited storage capacity. And all of those are common in the region. The development yields from dilution models will be based on the privately owned developable areas and won't include preserved lands within the subwatershed. This gets again to the analysis that we've been undergoing with the help of the GIS department so that we can actually know what those lands are. We're working on a method that will reflect this recommended approach, and the goal of the method is to determine the capacity of the system to sustain additional septic systems for each of the zones in each watershed without violating nitrate objectives for the area. So really that's as far as we've gotten for today. For the purpose of today, we are making progress. What we're doing now is we're doing further analysis so that we'll be able to bring to you more information so that you can make you can discuss those thresholds.
I mean, what do you mean when you say that you'll recognize the legislative distinction between the preservation and planning areas?
Well, what we're doing is we're referring back to the septic density goals for NJDEP rules in the preservation area. They're very clear. It's section 34E, and Tom did this work at a request of one of the council members, so it's very clear to us. That section requires a septic system density standard established at a level to prevent the degradation of water quality or to require the restoration of water quality and to protect ecological uses from individual, secondary, and cumulative impacts in consideration of deep aquifer recharge available for dilution. So it's very clear what must be done in the preservation area. For the regional master plan, the Highlands Act doesn't have such detailed specifics. For the regional master plan, the Act states that the resource assessment must determine the amount and type of human development and activity which the ecosystem of the Highlands region can sustain while still maintaining the overall ecological values thereof, with special reference to surface and groundwater quality and supply. Further, the smart growth component requires an analysis of appropriate densities based upon that assessment, while it doesn't specifically speak to septic density. Lastly, the goals from Section 10 are to protect, restore, and enhance the quality and quantity of surface and ground waters therein. And that's for both preservation and planning area. But if the goals go on for the planning area to state, and this is goal number 9, encourage consistent with the State Development and Redevelopment Plan and Smart Growth Strategies and Principles, appropriate patterns of compatible residential, commercial, and industrial development, redevelopment, and economic growth in or adjacent to areas already utilized for such purposes, and discourage piecemeal, scattered, and inappropriate development in order to accommodate local and regional growth and economic development in an orderly way while protecting the Highlands environment from the individual and cumulative adverse impacts thereof. So on the basis of this, we see that there is a differentiation in the treatment of the preservation area and the planning area. The goals, as laid out for us, are different. And it is extremely clear what the septic density as it applies to the preservation area. And that was not done, likewise, for the planning area. So, you know, and if you want further information from the council, I did bring this with me, as you can see today. I didn't know that it would be a direct question. I'm glad I did. Mm-hmm. But if you want some further information or from Tom, I offer him up.
I think the question would be more specifically answered, as indicated earlier, on a case-by-case basis, when you get to the ground, this question will become quite apparent, and it's, to the answer to this question will become quite apparent as you apply whatever these rules are.
Yes, I think that...
I couldn't hear you, Jack.
I didn't say much. All I was saying was that the answer to the question will become manifest when it's applied.
Yes,
the rules are applied.
When we come back with the thresholds, then I think that will, you know, certainly that will be a conversation that will then occur, because you will be able to measure have we met the mandates of the Act as they apply to both of those areas. And forgive me for reading the answer to you today, Jack, but I think it needs to be very explicit in that it's not my telling of what I see in the Act, but my reading from it as given by Tom.
I was just checking to see if you've done your homework, and you obviously have.
I think it'd be helpful to just send that page to the President Council and have it in front of it. I think many of us use the phrase line to line, and I think that has certain relevance use, but it also is maybe a little deceptive because the Act does treat the two parts of the islands somewhat differently in some areas.
I'll be glad to write it up.
Okay, thanks.
I think it's, and I had this conversation also with Eileen and Tom about the sort of the interpretation of what that differentiation in the language of the Act means, because the statutory directive to us to protect, enhance, and restore applies to the entire region, and clearly, you know, where the rubber meets the road is going to be in what we're talking about happens to actual water quality as a consequence of the levels of growth or septic system density that we're going to allow under these policies. And I mean, I guess I see in part the statutory language as being very prescriptive to us in the preservation area and to the DEP, and not quite as prescriptive, but perhaps not as different in those overall goals. And I guess where I'm going to be interested in seeing how the thresholds and the numbers play out is in what I would call the concept of backsliding, which is we have a situation where water quality ranges in its quality across the Highlands. Plus it's impaired, plus it's in very, very good condition. And sort of one of the fundamental tenets of the Clean Water Act is we don't allow good water quality to become degraded. And so I would hate to see this conversation lead in that direction. And I'm not implying that the staff is crafty, it does, but there has been public comment about, well, we gave you the preservation area, therefore all this growth should go into the planning area. And I just want to raise the idea that there are similar boundaries to how much of that growth can be accommodated So and the numbers are going to be key to the policies and to the consequences of allocating density across the classifications and otherwise. So I don't think that this conversation can be complete, nor can we necessarily give you a lot of, from my personal perspective, a lot of firm direction on these suggestions right now without seeing what those thresholds are, because it is part of the same thing. And then just one last comment, which is, I think we also need to be cognizant of the fact that nitrates are pollutants in and of their own right and can cause public health consequences in particular. So they're not just indicators, they are. So we need to manage for them, and particularly in groundwater, water supply sources as well as their use as an indicator of other pollutants that come along.
Right, and in answer to that, the last comment, Tim, we are looking at, you know, BMPs and incentivizing approaches in farming situations, agricultural situations that may ameliorate the nitrate loading. So we are, you know, aware of that. I think the answer, you're correct in saying that this is a conversation that's going to occur again when we bring that information to you, because then you'll be able to see what the net effect is. At the same time, we're asking the same, we're setting the bar for ourselves again at scientific, legal, and good planning, and adding to that, and I guess in every case, the mandate of the Act to try to make sure that we keep our eye on the goal in that sense as well. And we've done, I don't know how many times over the past few weeks, we've sat down and looked at numbers and at analysis on a sub-watershed level and looked at the nitrate loadings in each of the sub-watersheds. So there's been, again, a tremendous amount of progress made. But we want to make sure that when we bring it to you, we've done the due diligence on each of the elements, whether it's, again, science, looking at it from the legal aspect, so that when we bring it to you, we really feel that we're in a strong place to make a recommendation to you that then you act upon. And that's why we wanted a little extra time. We certainly could outline what, you know, the basis that I gave you today on, you know, for two areas where we spoke to the Act then, the treatment of the different zones within, but more discussion on that when we bring you the next information. And if asked again on the question of timing, because we've got, you know, goal here, and I was asked about how this affects our timing, we did build in, believe it or not, and it's small, but we did build into the schedule an opportunity to come back and sooner rather than later, but to come back and have further discussion on some of these items.
I have a few questions.
Just a minute, Debbie. Tracy?
Just a couple things. I understand what you're saying about the legislative distinction, but I think we also have to recognize that there is a scientific basis for using the most accurate methods, and the deep aquifer recharge model that is prescribed is the most accurate method. That's why it was prescribed for the hard rock geology of the highlands. So the Act does not say it cannot be used in the planning area, and we have to remain committed to using the most scientifically accurate methods in order to get to the answers. And so I just wanted to say that, but I believe that even though it's not mandated to be used in the planning area, that we must continue to consider the use of the deep aquifer recharge model for the entire Highlands region, as we have discussed over the last couple of years. Also, and that's a matter of accuracy. In terms of protection, there is another requirement in the Act that says that only standard systems can be used in the preservation area. That is a protective measure. I think we have considered that for use in the planning area in the draft, and we should continue to consider that as a protective measure, and that's because of the concern associated with nitrate plumes that result from anything from septic systems. Also, just wanted to put out there, you discuss here about the water quality management plan and groundwater quality standards established, you know, statewide on the proposal of 2 milligrams per liter. I certainly agree that that's better than the 5.6, I think that's used by DEP now, and they do their 50-unit and higher subdivision review.
And it's certainly better than the 10 milligram per liter standard. But that, I just want to point out that that is above the median background concentration for that we have found through data in the conservation zone in the Highlands, which is the 1.88. Mm-hmm. So that 2 milligrams per liter is actually allowing for some degradation. You may say it's de minimis, but I don't know that it is. So I think we need to look at that. Also, I know that we will be discussing this, you know, at length at another meeting. So I'll hold back on the comments, but I think there are a lot of thorny issues associated with this, and we're going to need to have at least one meeting, but I think, and I hope you mentioned here that there's going to be some staff meetings with consultants and discussions with USGS. Perhaps the council can be included in that, or we can get some, you know, technical information, if not being included at the meeting itself, you know, following those meetings. But I think we really need, because I think there's a lot of questions here, and the devil's in the details on this, on the nitrate dilution and the septic density. So I just want to, you know, be apprised at every step of the way as we move forward, and I think the other council members would want to be too.
Okay, we'll do that. We can commit to sort of a running, you know, sharing of the information and the technical information as we get it, and work with those, with the consultants on this.
Given that we're coming back to this, let's move on next.
Okay. Agricultural resources. Concerns were raised over the use of the important farmers.
Oh, excuse me. I had questions.
I'm sorry, Debbie.
So when are we going to see the septic density data?
We're aiming to have more information for you by October 4th.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Which means, of course, that you folks will be seeing it 10 days ahead of that.
The question about recommendation number 2, does this statement relate to both the planning of the preservation and the preservation area, or just one?
When we're doing modeling assumptions, we'll use the same wherever we're doing modeling assumptions. We're using the same information, which is like things like four people per household, that kind of information. So the modeling assumptions will be the same in both areas.
Okay. Thank you. That's all.
Am I moving on to agricultural?
Yes, you are.
Agricultural resources. This is the concerns that were raised over the use of farmland, important farmland soils in the regional master plan in development of agricultural resource area and the conservation zone. And this is the four types of soils that were used: prime, statewide, important, and important and local and unique. We had a meeting with Department of Agriculture and the SADC, and showed them the analysis of how we, you know, of the use of those soils in that area, and they were content with the analysis and supportive of it, and then, because they had given us comments before that questioned those uses, but then in response to that meeting, what we're saying is that there will be no change in the lands model, because they're content with that analysis. They believe it was correct, and that it captured the vast majority of the critically important soils. The question, though, that they did have for us, or the concerns that they raised, was how the prioritization of agriculture for preservation purposes. Specifically, they asked us to look at farms that have 50% or more prime soils, and farms that are contiguous to, and that is within a mile of, other preserved farms. They wanted those to be factored in as minimum standards for ranking farms for preservation. So we're working with them on that. By the same token, we discussed with them that we would prioritize farms in some cases for different reasons than they would. And the example I'd give you is if a farm is on the headwaters for a watershed area, it would be a high priority for us to have considered for farmland preservation. And so and they were pleased to work with us on those issues as well. So we're going to continue to work with them on the prioritization. But as regards the mapping for in the lands map, which will again be the new model, they're content with the methodologies used.
What is the plan for advising the CADDs and the counties of
Jack, I can't hear you.
Sorry about that.
And I don't want to miss a single word.
Sorry, Debbie. I'll do the best I can. I'm a little hoarse today. I was a little deer yesterday, but I'm a little hoarse. What is the plan for advising the CADBs on prioritization requirements after they finish?
Well, now that you brought it up, Jack will make sure that we do and that we include them when we come up with the prioritization. We'll work with SADC and loop the CADBs into it.
Because they are the ones who actually make the determinations about farmland conservation and apply the funding.
Right, and we have been contacted by several of the county planners who are at present working on those initiatives. Some of them are in the room today, so we'll continue to work with them. Thanks.
Clarify a point on the soils. I think that there's one perspective is utilizing primed soils to help identify lands that are desired as one of the indicators for the possibility of having viable agriculture. But wasn't the issue also that these prime soils were being used as an indicator to prevent development? Excuse me. And that was the issue that standing by itself, that the use of the soils to designate land as inappropriate for development without considering all the other elements for a viable farm didn't cut the mustard.
I think one aspect of this we have deferred to a later meeting is, I think, your issue, which is examining soils as it relates to clustering and resource protection and soil protection. We have put that on a future meeting agenda with our consultants to address how we cluster, how resources are protected. So we will revisit that. The issue we're trying to advance today is for the lands model itself, utilizing them, all soils in terms of the lands model. But we will definitely revisit that issue in terms of cluster and resource protection.
So where you are now is in terms of clarifying the definition but not the policy.
The definition for the purposes of the lands model, so that this is how we will proceed on, because we're going to be running that model. So I want to make sure we have all the answers. Roger's looking at me there. It takes a considerable amount of time to run the model. But as regards what Tom was saying, yes, that was part of the discussion with Department of Ag and SADC.
Could you do anything else?
No.
Other than the model.
Meeting's complete now.
The next issue number 11, was vernal pool boundaries. This, again, we received many comments from public advocacy groups and council on the 1,000-foot buffer, so around NJDEP confirmed vernal pools. So what we wanted to do was to go back and look at that and consider whether it was, again, scientifically defensible and an appropriate resource protection area for the sensitive habitats that are associated with these vernal pools. So switching documents here. What we did certainly find scientific basis for the 1,000-foot buffers. We're looking to do a further tiering of those of the buffer areas and further review then of the 1,000-foot that surrounds these vernal pools. So we recommend the continued use of the buffer for the development of the lands model, which again is critical for today's purposes, being able to move the lands model forward. And for development review, though, we're recommending a more refined review zones be established to create tiers of protection around vernal pools. And those tiers would be based upon the quality and ecological significance. And those vernal pools would be scored for biological value and critical terrestrial habitat condition.
Dependent on species.
Mm-hmm.
In each case.
Sorry?
Dependent on species in each case.
Well, the buffer would be there in the lands model. There would be a 1,000-foot buffer established for all those vernal pools.
The tiering would reduce that 1,000 feet in certain cases or expand it?
No, the tiering would define the 1,000-foot. It wouldn't expand it.
So it could reduce it.
For review purpose, it could reduce the, how on a site-by-site basis, it could review what would be allowable uses within that zone.
So, for the area that would be considered for applying the vernal pool policy, it would be 1,000 feet, essentially.
Yes, and it would be mapped as such.
Mr. Chairman, I guess a couple things. One is, again, I'm not sure what the impetus for the recommended change is. It's not laid out in here as to, so within the scope of a policy decision, what's appropriate about what was laid out before. I think it is significant. We're talking about, you know, a buffer zone, which in my terminology is an unaltered area, converting that to a review zone in which there may be some degree of alteration allowed within. And I think that's significant from the habitat management perspective. And then I think the second part of it that I think we have to consider, which I think it's very difficult that once you start to allow incursions into what are primarily designed to be unaltered buffer zones, you get into huge management problems. And you just have to look at any of the buffer zones that are in place, whether those are in the freshwater wetlands program or the coastal program. It's just very, very difficult once you make an allowance to then manage it. So I think that that's a part of the consideration here. I think it's simpler, more straightforward. It seems to be supported by the science in terms of the habitat needs of the animals that utilize these vernal ponds, the scarcity and the criticality of the resource itself. Those, I think, are considerations that I don't see in here, but are be part of the discussion.
I wanted
to say that I want to see us stick with the 100-foot buffer, and I
1,000-foot
buffer. And sorry, and I think I may be semantics, but the way the recommendation is written, it sounds as if you're saying continued use of the 1,000-foot buffer. And then you say for development review, we recommend more refined review zones. I think we should just be more explicit about what we're really talking about here. And I think Tim's point of calling it a review zone does make it clear. I would argue against changing it to a review zone. I think for the reasons that Tim already said, and I won't repeat them, we need the buffer. We need the buffer to be the line in the sand. And I think that we need to do further scientific reference research. I see that, you know, you have some new references here and talk about tiered approaches, but I also noticed that you picked out the references that only talk about reducing it to a 750 or 400 foot tiered approach and not the references that support the 1,000 foot buffer as an absolute line. So I would like to ask the staff to do further research into the support of the 1,000-foot buffer, not just a tiered approach, and that we reconsider allowing activities to intrude into that buffer area.
Are there other council comments before we respond?
I'm just going to say that this discussion reminds me of something I was told a long time ago. I was picking apples with Mr. Parks here in Chester when I was a kid. I got a good joke. He was in his 70s at the time. He said, one day his fellow son came home from school and said, "What did you learn in geometry class?" And the son responded, "Well, today we learned that pi is r squared." "Pi is r squared? I can't believe my tax dollars are paying for you to be taught that pi r squared. Everybody knows pi is around. But the pi r squared comes to understanding what this 1,000-foot buffer is, and it's over 7 acres. So what, 70, excuse me. Is that correct? Is my long-term map wrong? 72, wrong decimal point. So are we suggesting that the habitat of a spotted salamander justifies 72 acres of land? Or are we suggesting that this salamander, through social Darwinism, can't figure out that if he goes this way and hits a house, he just turns left and goes back to where there's more open space? You know, This thing is nuts. As far as I'm concerned, I mean, you can live on a home on a 5-acre lot with a 5-person family, but a salamander needs that kind of space. You know, so I encourage a tiered approach to this. I've got a salamander in my basement. I hope it doesn't mean I have a vernal pool.
I'd just like to say, it's not what we say it needs. It's what it tells us it needs. And that's where the science is.
What is the value of a salamander versus the human life? You know, and I think that we have to reconcile some of these fundamental decisions, because there is a point where human life and human habitat perhaps is more important than the life of a spotted salamander. We don't have woolly mammoths roaming around in New Jersey anymore, and is our life bad because we don't have woolly mammoths?
I think
we don't need to get enough.
I have a question.
Bottom line is, I support the tiered approach.
Okay. Debbie?
I was a little troubled when I read this, only because I don't want to use the word deceitful, that's not the right word, but I was troubled at how, we either have buffers or we don't, and I don't understand how we can objectively, and I think that's important, to be objective rather than subjective, how we can create these tiers, and I'm not weighing in pro or con on 1,000 foot, just what we need to set a standard and we need to implement it objectively. And I just don't see how we can do that with these tiers.
I think the answer probably is what Eileen was referring to earlier as being environmentally and legally defensible. If we can meet that standard, I think that we might be fine. And not everything is black and white. Not everything requires 1,000-foot buffer. I think it's okay to put it in as a guide. But if there's a scientifically valid and legally defensible way of reducing that for the benefit of the private property owner, which is what we're talking about here, I think that's not unreasonable.
But how's that done? And I may have missed it. There was some interference on the Sadger. I might have missed part of the explanation. So I apologize if it's repetitive. But you know, give me, for instance, an example. Whoever's doing this.
For purposes of today, what we're saying is that we will use the 1,000-foot buffer in the lands model, and I haven't heard an argument against that. And then what we said is, for development review, we recommend that more refined review zones be established. So that requires us to work more on those. We did give you some information in the documentation we sent you. From the Conservation Alliance, Michael Clemens' work, that shows how you can establish these tiers. But for purposes of today, clearly that we're moving forward with the lands model with the 1,000-foot buffer, and then that we're recommending that we do the analysis and bring back to you those tiers.
Okay, and you know, I've been on vacation a few weeks. Could somebody resend to me the document that Eileen's referring to? I'll take another look at that to try and answer my question.
We'll do that today, Debbie.
Thank you.
Okay. Karst topography. Again, we received comments on the mapping of karst topography, the need to do so. For many reasons, both environmental and from a safety perspective, these kind of carbonate rock formations are known for, you know, sinkholes and these kind of issues, as well as for directing surface water runoff. Those sinkholes function as funnels, and they direct surface water runoff into these karst aquifers with little or no attenuation of transported contaminants. So clearly, karst topography is an issue for these two reasons, and it's one that we, in response to the comments received, we know that we can map them, and we're prepared to do that, and it will not be an indicator into the lands model, but this type of topography will be mapped into the next generation of the plan, and we would use existing NJGS and United States Geological Survey data for those areas that are underlain by the carbonate rocks. And further, that we would also show the land areas that drain surface water into those rock areas as well, because changes in the quantity, quality, and rate of discharge from those surface water runoffs from those upslope lands can impair the water resources in that rock area. So we'll be mapping those.
Eileen, I have a question about that. Is this Highlands Council data, or is this other data in the public domain that's going to be used for this?
It's other data in the public domain. Dan, do you want to speak to that?
Yeah, it's existing geological information from both the state and the federal geological surveys.
So this is something that's been available to counties and municipalities, but they may not have been utilizing it to maximum benefit.
That's true. Some have already adopted limestone ordinances, right. Topography ordinances, and others have not.
And that's why I ask, because this isn't new. I mean, this has been around a while, but not every municipality may have opted to do this. So, okay, just wanted to clarify.
And what we felt was important, again, is in response to comments received, when we can respond to those comments and give that mapping, it will be useful to municipalities, because everything we have, we share with them. And so, again, those that have it, it's fine, but we can provide it to them with other layers when we're working with them, either through conformance or when we're working with them as partners, regardless of whether they're conforming or not. But we can give them the benefit of the data layers that we're putting together.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I think it's great we're including this. I just want to point out we're putting a lot of import on the model ordinance. Since it's not going to be an indicator, it's just information. That makes the model ordinance key in terms of saying what we think should or should not be done in the karst geology. Activities that are appropriate, management measures that need to be taken if you are going to do a certain activity. So we really need to work on a stellar model ordinance and on this. And question about that. These model ordinances that we're putting together, we're going to present these to the municipality at the time of conformance. Is that correct, or are we going to have our model ordinances together at the time of the plan?
So that sort of leads into the next topic, so. I want to sort of so, take that answer as an opportunity to go into
okay, the great. We can use it as a segue.
The next issue is to make sure that you all understand what it is we believe we can accomplish during this work program. One of the comments that was received, one of the comments we made in our recommendations to you was that the notion of we'll resolve this during conformance without setting a standard, setting a program that's substantive in its character, really doesn't provide a guide for negotiations and collaboration with the municipalities. So we have recommended that wherever you have a goal, policy, and objective that requires a program, there should be a program in this plan. Given the time frame, it's not possible for a consultant team to start out and draft anew a tailored regulation or program for every one of those goals, policies, and objectives. In some cases, we will do that. There are some critical areas, and we expect to fully do that. But in a lot of cases, either Lane Kendig's firm or our firm have previously established a whole variety. We probably between us have 40 or 50 clustering regulations that we've used. And where one is appropriate that we've prepared before, and we believe will set a minimum basic program that will achieve the goals, policies, and objectives of the plan, we're going to put it in place. But we also believe, because that tailoring is an important part of the regulatory process, that those programs should leave the opportunity for municipalities to provide a better mousetrap, for lack of a more descriptive term. Now, we will provide some model ordinances. I can't promise you that there'll be model ordinances for every single program. The program, in the program element, will have all the substantive elements that ought to be in a local program. And in many cases, there'll actually be the text of a model ordinance, but it won't be in the plan. It'll be a resource material that will accompany the plan and will be available during the conformance process. That is a work program that we believe we can fairly and competently satisfy in the time frame that's available. But we don't believe that we could, start from ground zero and prepare all the programs and prepare them all in model ordinance form and event them to specifically be tailored to this language. And that we just wanted to make sure that everybody understands that's how we're going to produce this product.
question about the model ordinances then. That's great, that, and I know that we have been collecting them, too, over a couple of years. These ordinances then, since they're not going to be part of the plan, does that make them more open to updating and changing? I mean, if we're going to amend the plan, it's a big process, but if we find a better mousetrap, to use your phrase, or, you know, refine a model ordinance, we'll be able to do that outside of official action. I mean, I can see where this would be a help, and I can also see where it would, you know, also get a little dicey.
But that's the conformance process itself.
Okay.
That when this council approves a municipal plan and ordinances, updated the master plan, you will be reviewing their updated ordinances and master plans. So you will have an official obligation and an opportunity to make those determinations at that point.
So the purpose of the model ordinance is to make the first steps easier for the municipality.
Correct.
In drafting whatever they want to put forward to us, for us to navigate.
But the programs are programmed, and they're program substantive elements required in those programs. They aren't the text of an ordinance that says, now, therefore, be it resolved that. There will be models that contain that language, but the plan has substantive programs, and they would be implemented specific ordinances, the model, an adapted model, or potentially a whole new ordinance drafted by local government.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I just on that sort of negotiated aspect of this, I would just remind that we had a fairly rigorous debate about the idea that during conformance alternatives to standards and other things could be offered. And I think we decided that we would not allow that to go forward. So, I mean, I'll look forward to see how you frame out what you just described as the program elements, but, you know, the process is conformance. And while there clearly is some discretion in there, the way this language is written here, it seems to me to reopen that debate that I thought we had settled once about municipalities or counties offering alternatives to the standards. And so it's going to be, I guess, which box the substance falls within, whether it's a programmatic element, you know, a standard, or whether it's we want to write the sentence this way versus that way. But I just want to raise that caution that the way I read this text in the memo is it seemed to reopen the debate that I thought we had settled, that it was conformance.
Well, I hope we had hoped that the language equal to or superior to the substantive provisions of the RMP would make clear that it's not the what but the how.
Yeah, I think we probably will need to come back to that, but I don't think that is settled in that direction. I think we did discuss it, but
we took a vote on it.
Yeah,
so we have to go back to it.
Right.
Okay. The last three issues, I was going to say these should be easy, but maybe I should wait and tell you whether they were when I reached the end. These are technical issues. They're updates. They're not, I don't think they're requiring of the same sort of thought that went into what we've just dealt with, the previous 11. The first issue is a technical issue on exemptions. We know there are 17 exemptions. We know that we, to date, haven't sort of done a mapping exercise that shows the cumulative effect of those exemptions. And in working with Lane Kendig and Charlie, the GIS department was asked, what could they do to map exemptions? And they, again, worked very diligently and have recommended an analysis which focuses on the exemptions 1, 2, 4, and 5, which are the ones that will have the greatest impact. And they are doing an approach that's including the use of 2005 Mod 4 data and Highlands composite zone data. And that Mod 4 data goes from January 10th, 2004 through January 9th, 2005. So it's the closest to the enactment of the Highlands Act. And so they're going to do an analysis and be able to map those exemptions so that we will have a sort of a visual picture of what those exemptions look like and then can consider the effects of those. So I think that's an important ability and something that's going to be useful to you and to the public to see how that maps out. The next issue, state plan designated centres. In comments received and from our and from other state agencies also, we were asked about the mapping of those designated centres. There are 21 state designated centres within the Highlands region, and what we're proposing here is to map those and to show, when mapping them, to show their expiration dates. Many of them, they expire somewhere between 2008 and I believe 2010, and the majority in the earlier. So we're going to map, what we're suggesting to you is that we will map those, not as part of the lands model, as a separate mapping. Show them and show the expiration dates. And in addition, what we will have a look at is the nature and extent of environmentally sensitive or resource features that are within those designated centres. And that would be an exercise that would, of evaluation, and be included in a narrative to the smart growth component. We think this will be useful in working with, again, with our other, with sister agencies in what, you know, in when those centres expire, we can work with the sister agencies then on what would happen into the future. And I would remind you that those centres were not designated through the plan endorsement process, which is a much more comprehensive process than the designation of those centres as it was done in the past. So we look forward to being able to work with the other agencies on these issues.
Just one question. I think in that mapping, is it going to show where there are conflicts between what the RMP recommends and what this grid state plan boundaries are? So if there's a protection area in the land use conservation map, capability map, indicated it's inside a growth boundary as designated by the center status, are we going to show that?
Today I was committing to the mapping, and I mean I'd have to turn to Roger to see if that's possible, because again, and I don't want him to nod yet, because he has to make sure we can meet all the other obligations and all the other commitments we've made to you in the time frame. But if it is, I understand the question, if it is possible to show where, for example, a protection zone might insert itself into a state planning, a state plan designated centre, we will do so. He's saying yes now.
I have a comment on that. If we don't have the time to include where the conflicts are, I would probably object to including this in the plan, because that would be the purpose of doing it relative to our mission. And I'm bringing this issue up as I have to get off the phone in the next 2 minutes, but I'd like to leave this as an open issue that we need further discussion on.
Why? I mean, if we have the information about the centers, why wouldn't we want to show it? You want to have it there and have it be as...
What would it be used for? I mean, there's lots of things that are available we're not including in the plan. I mean, I'm sure there's reams of data and maps and things that it's relevant and it's to our purposes. I don't know. I think we'd need to talk about this some more, why we would... I don't see why we'd do it if it doesn't have some utility to our mission.
It can't hurt.
Oh, I think it could hurt, and I think that's what we need to talk about.
Well, I will tell you.
Okay. Well, I think we need to get the answers to the questions that are on the table.
Yep.
So it's okay.
Can I just add, Mr. Chair, that it is in response to requests, comments received from municipalities and counties and their planning departments that we map this. So that's part of the answer, but I'll leave that to you as to whether you include it or not. And the final, the inventory of potentially contaminated sites, brownfield sites. Again, the master plan encourages the redevelopment of these sites, but considered the updating of the inventory was to be taken during pre-conformance. So what we did was we looked at that, and we do have contaminated site inventory, and what we were suggesting is that the 2005 data set is generally sufficient, but we were going to add to it the 17 Highland sites that are included in the NJDEP's non-operating landfills with evidence of groundwater impact. So we're going to add that to that layer. Final issue, and we're just using this one as an example. This is an issue of steep slopes. Where we've received comments on if there are differences between the treatment in the regional plan and how NJDEP treats an issue, what we would like to use this as an example, that we do rely on what the DEP rules, but sometimes we will have additional standards, which, because of your work in drafting the plan, that you feel are appropriate. And the example, when it came to the steep slopes, was that we would have additional standards for steep slopes within riparian corridors, because that wasn't covered by the DEP rules. So that's just, this is an example, and in response to comments, of why sometimes there's additional information or additional policies from the Highlands Council, and it's because of our particular mission, which is more specific in the Highlands region than perhaps the DEP's approach on a statewide level.
Comments, questions on any of these topics? I have to vote on this after the work that went into this. The next item on our agenda is public comment. Let me, I assume we have food for members?
Yes, we have food for members.
How many members of the public would like to speak? Well, I guess, I don't know what member schedules are like, but if individuals want to go grab food and bring it back and give public comments, or wait till we're all done.
But
I think we'll keep going.
Can we take a 5-minute break to get the food and bring it back?
Mr. Chair, I've got one quick piece of business.
Okay.
If I could, before you dismiss, I have a gift for you.
I don't know if I'm allowed to accept gifts.
I have a gift.
Okay.
Well, it turns out that you don't like disdain for the Ethics Commission, their efforts to prevent us from having elected representatives discuss and represent their constituents here on the council. Well, my disdain was only furthered when I found out that hand-delivering my financial disclosure to our ethics officer on the due date and simultaneously sending the original certified mail signature confirmation to Trenton wasn't sufficient. So I was duly provided with a $50 fine for serving in a non-paying capacity. So our executive director and our ethics officer sought clarification to see if they really meant it, and they really meant it. So unless you want me to resign, I need to pay a $50 fine. So I brought the fine today, and I'm going to allow you to hand deliver it down to the Ethics Commission. So it's not a good thing. I would like to receive.
Okay, here are the guys.
You guys count them. You're the receipt. And I have satisfied my indebtedness to the state of New Jersey.
I have no comment. I think that's what I heard my direction was.
So a little bit of fun on an issue that stinks. And Glenn's got it worse than me.
God, and I thought it was fresh fruit.
Because they didn't accept Glenn's freeholder disclosure to be sufficient for the Highlands Council disclosure. Same form. So they fined him $150 because he was 3 days after finding out that they wouldn't accept the same form for both positions. Of course, all he did was photocopy it and white out the name.
Both state forms, right? Same topic, right?
Yes. Yeah, so was this our 5-minute break? Okay, we'll come back in 5 minutes and do public comment. Okay.
Would you like to carry that to your office?
You know, Kurt, I really would appreciate you. Because I think managing the cash is important. Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
As usual, we'll begin with those members of the public who have not spoken to the council before. Okay. Those members who have spoken before, who would like to speak? And we're obviously taking notes, and those members of the council who are in the hall or about to leave will get filled in on what you're all saying. Thank you for your patience.
Good afternoon. I'm Robin O'Hearn, the director of Skylands Clean. As one of the most vocal critics of several elements of the regional master plan, specifically the planned community zones, specially planned areas, the land use capability map, the wastewater management mapping, and water supply issues, I want to thank the council and staff for revisiting these important areas of the plan. And I'm encouraged and cautiously optimistic by the fine-tuning of the plan that has been discussed today. Of course, the proof will be in the mapping, hopefully in November I'll be seeing a map with a whole lot less purple and a whole lot more green. And I just want to remind the council that while the lake communities were the poster children of the planned community zones, that many other constrained areas, including portions of the Pequannock River and areas surrounding some public water supply wells, were also included in the planned community zones. So I'm hoping that once the constraints are applied under the new mapping, that those areas will also be removed from areas deemed as having growth potential. I also share the concerns expressed today regarding the new enhanced growth potential indicators, especially if environmental constraints are not identified and removed first. And we would also oppose any use of an eminent domain for these areas being identified for growth and taking those. One housekeeping question. Based on the recent issue with the strip mall in Independence Township that was stopped and revoked, the Highlands exemption for that project was revoked because they hadn't proceeded beyond site plan, site preparation. There are a lot of grandfathered projects out there that have not proceeded beyond that point, and I'm wondering that since those exemptions expired on August 10th, has the council or the DEP created any formal policy for going through the process of formally revoking those exemptions? And Eagle Ridge and Valley Ridge are both in that boat, and they come to mind as well. So I'm just curious if there's been any movement on that or any progress. Thanks.
I mean, it would be a DEP call.
My understanding is they have been issuing letters to those that applied.
Okay, great.
Those who applied for exemptions?
For those exemptions.
Oh, okay.
For exemption number three, which expires.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Anyone else like to speak? Yes, sir.
David Shope. I have a farm in Hunterdon County. A couple things. Number one, I took note of who did most of the talking today. From the council members, and they are the more they are the environmentalists who don't want to see another thing built here, and will use any avenue possible to make sure that it happens. Just take note of who did most of the talking from the council, and you will know who I'm talking about. On the issue of water, you talk about water deficit areas. You're talking about a water deficit area of an area that is supposedly the area that supplies water to 5.5 million New Jerseyans. A water deficit area in an area that supplies this amount of water to other people is ludicrous on its face. Basically, what you're saying is the cities are entitled to the surface water, and those of us who live in the Highlands area are entitled to literally the water that falls in the cracks in the rocks. That's what you're saying. Clinton, which has part of Spruce Run Reservoir as part of its municipal boundary, can't use that water, nor can any other downstream thing, entity that I know of. This issue of water is essentially a colonial issue. The Highlands area is essentially a colony supplying raw material to the rest of the state, to the rest of the state's benefit and to our detriment. In addition to that, New Jersey American Water alone supplies $58 million a year in terms of franchise, excise, and gross receipts tax to the state. We supply the water. New Jersey American Water sells it at quite a profit and feeds the state's coffers $58 million a year's worth. This is not about water. This is not about water deficit. This is about money and water flowing concurrently to the cities. Up here, Glen Gardner, Washington Township have had water restrictions for a couple of months now, as they typically do every summer. In the meantime, if you have a $70,000 SUV in your $7,500,000 home in Westfield, you can continue to wash it in your driveway. That's the water issue. So, septic density. The idea of using the drought conditions for calculating septic density is contrary to the state method of commonly known as GRS 32. it, again, is another restrictive tool so that no development can occur. That's all it is. It's not imaginative science. It's corrupt science with no basis in current use. I found it interesting that the SADC and the New Jersey Department of Agriculture elected not to define any distinction in soil types. Why, for year after year, have I been having to do this in my farmland applications if there is no distinction? That in itself is stupid. And on the issue of limestone, I keep on hearing about the great potential danger of building on limestone. Show me. Give me a statistical analysis. Give me numbers of the number of people that have been swallowed up by sinkholes in limestone. I think you'll find you have a greater chance of falling out of the sky in an airplane, quite frankly. Thank you.
Thank you. Any comments?
Julia Summers, New Jersey Highlands Coalition. Well, we knew it would be a meaty day, and indeed, it has proven to be so. But I feel like we've only got maybe the hors d'oeuvre. We've just begun the meal, and it's very hard to be able to comment on the meal without all the other parts, most particularly the programs that will back up what we're seeing. I recognize that today we were really talking about policies that affect the MAC, but they're all part of the whole, and it's very hard to comment in an intelligent way, I hope, without knowing more about the programs.
You're going to comment, right?
But I had some questions. I had some questions. And perhaps Eileen could give this to me later, but you zoomed through all those roads in the transportation section, and I'd like to get those numbers from you. The cost mapping, and in fact you talked about mapping in a couple of different places, that seems to be separate from the lands map. This is separate mapping. It's mapping that will be made available to every town during the conformance process?
Yes, fine.
And every town that it affects, well, and if it doesn't affect, the ordinance won't matter, but every town will be required to have an ordinance on cost as part of the conformance process?
We'd like your comments, and if you want to put questions on the table, you understand, get back to
you. Okay, and the last is a comment about vernal pools. Vernal pools are defined by and certified by DEP, so unless they've done that to your basement, Kurt, I don't think you've got a vernal pool down there, nor will any unwitting person ever likely have one. Thank you.
Afternoon, everybody. Thanks for letting me speak here today. My name is Hank Klepp. I'm a farmer in Tewksbury. I own 150 acres in the Highlands Preservation area. And as for Mr. Seaman's comment about the weddings, for 3 years, I've been standing before this council. That is how long you have had my family's future in your hands. People find it incredible that a council of 15 people who come and go like the wind could be making such drastic decisions concerning properties that have been in my family for three generations. It's a council with members standing to lose nothing, and an audience usually filled with environmentalists, many paid, who seem to think it is just fine to steal my property values. These meetings are never scheduled to accommodate a farmer's schedule, and yet it is a farmer who stands to lose life investments if the Highlands Act that was supposed to hurt no one isn't totally revised to stop the theft and totally compensate landowners with the real estate values they are entitled to. The fairness of this matter is really quite simple and doesn't require a $250,000 planner to figure it out. The truth speaks for itself. My property value is being stolen. My property was not in the original Highlands Preservation Area. Mysteriously, the boundary line was moved by an eraser in the hands of a politician. Thank you very much. I appreciate the time speaking here today.
Thank you very much for allowing us to become partners in this whole process. But what happens now? Can we send you written comments based
yes.
on this meeting?
Yes.
I mean, right away, obviously.
Yeah. There's no okay. formal deadline, but obviously the sooner we get them, the better, and the more we'll be able to make use of them.
Good. Okay. is Charlie Siemens going to get copies of our comments today, I noticed?
He is actually here.
Oh, he is back there. Okay. Beg your pardon. Why these issues only? How were they determined to be the ones that needed to be discussed, and are there going to be others?
But I'd like to hear your comments, you know, not a question, answer, back and forth.
Well, that's a comment.
Okay,
we're wondering
okay.
why these issues, and there's lots and lots that have come up. The map I'm beginning to see as many maps, and are the tiers that they're reflected on the map mean that the map areas are going to get smaller and smaller, or you won't be able to see those tiers at all. And I think that there's got to be some effort to make sure that you council members see the effects of all these regulations and on the land. And certainly the county should have a map that shows all the restrictions and all the potential development areas in one map. Even if it's black, that's the need to have an aggregated map. I think we'd be in favor of the tier approach. There's got to be more detail in this very diverse area, even more than you presented today. We're concerned about some of the changes because, and I'll detail these in my written comments, but there's about six things that we talked about today that seem to put more restrictions on good farmland, possibly for agricultural purposes. I see a good start in addressing smart growth and the transportation questions that weren't dealt with, but how about economic development? I don't see anything in the schedule for dealing with that. And is there an economist that's going to take a look at this and make some suggestions on how to fulfill that part of the act? That's very important from the industry's point of view. In the transportation, please also include some place, maybe in the policies, to take a look at the roads that give farmers in the Highlands problems, the bridges, the intersections where they can't turn with their big rigs and so forth. So there is a model for that in the Burlington County 206 transportation study. And the 40 or 50 cluster ordinances that are available, is there some way that Farm Bureau could see some of those ordinances, especially the ones that might be considered for use in the Highlands? This is absolutely critical to the conservation zone. And if there are that many models out there, we have a few of them, but we don't have 40 or 50. So we would like to have, in advance of the discussion on clusters, if possible, some of these potential clusters. And finally, we learned in this that there's 111 acres of prime farmland mapped in the ag resource area. And I'd like to point out the assumption that the farmers make that those prime farmland can be used for anything. That's the definition, without any sorts of measures that you need to take. So I think farmers need to know that the potential for the economic use of the very best farmland is going to be an assumption in the plan. And that we assume that times are going to get better for agriculture in the Highlands and not turn it into a wilderness area or an area that's just full of estates or perhaps, you know, just museum agriculture.
One clarification. My understanding of what Stephen was referring to was ordinances that his firm has been involved in putting together over the years, not a library the Highlands Council necessarily has.
Yes, that's my understanding too, but I wonder if he would share those with us.
You hire him. I don't know if we discussed that. Okay. Your other comments? Sir.
Good afternoon. My name is Rich Longo. My wife and I, Gretchen, live in Booton Township. We own 12 acres. We're in the preservation area. Originally, 95% of my town was in the preservation area, and most of the water in my town was in the preservation area. Somehow the boundaries were changed, and now approximately about 15% of my township is in the preservation area. And most of the water is now in the planting area. Our land values in my town have changed. Recently, my town just did a reevaluation of all the property in the town. After receiving my reval, I appealed the land portion assessment to my township. I met with the town assessor and with the professional appraiser hired by the township. My appeal was based on my vacant land being appraised and valued at the same rate as acreage in the planting area of my town. I asked the professional appraiser if he was aware of Public Law 2004, Chapter 120, the Highlands Water Protection Act. He stated he lived in Saddle Brook or Saddle River, and he didn't know nothing about that law. He denied my appeal. I then filed an appeal to the Morris County Board of Taxation. It was at a cost of a $100 non-refundable filing fee. After my hearing on the county level, my assessment was reduced somewhat, but not to the extent as a substantial loss of the value of my land that has occurred as a result of the Highlands Act. As the council knows, and I know, it is stated in the law that the landowners who have been harmed by the act will be compensated for the loss of the value of their land. Is this ever going to happen? The regional master plan is being developed to direct the municipalities on what they can or cannot be done or cannot do. I think the council, in their infinite wisdom, has to look at the problem of taxation as a result of the Highlands Act as it relates to landowners in the preservation area. And they have to do something with a classification. They have to direct the towns, the county, somebody to give a new classification to the landowners that live in a preservation area. It has to be done. We've been harmed, and I'm being taxed at the same rate as people in the planning area who have not been harmed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. As I've said before, my name is Andy Drysdale. My wife Lois and I live in own farmland at 32 East Fox Chase Road in Chester, New Jersey. We have been trapped in the preservation area since August of 2004. Some of our land is now in the conservation zone, which I guess is now going to change again, I guess. Of the regional master plan, which I guess is going to change its name, we, along with many others, are victims of environmental extremists who have led politicians, legislators, and the New Jersey DEP to do some unnecessary things. This is a tale of two hoaxes. The first one is probably one of the largest cover-ups ever perpetrated on the people of this entire country. It is the political map of the country that depicts the conservative states as red and the socialist-leaning states as blue. We all know that the Soviet Union and Communist China have for many years been depicted as red. What we don't know, or at least I do not know, who the people were that were the perpetrators of this huge hoax, although their intent to mislead the public is obvious. The second hoax is the New Jersey Highlands hoax. This hoax says that we must take away people's property rights to save the water, as well as many so-called endangered species. The reality is that there will always be plenty of water, and it can be purified wherever the need arises. As for endangered species, in many cases, they are more abundant than ever and can certainly be preserved without taking of property by the state. As for the people who perpetrated the second hoax, we do know who many of these people are. What we don't know here are all the individual motives. But in many cases, the intent was to mislead the public. The intent to mislead the public is obvious. The net result of these hoaxes, if they are allowed to continue, will be a loss of our free and democratic society. We need to stop this cancerous growth of government now. Thank you.
Thank you. Other comments?
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Pfeiffer. I'm a project manager for the Highlands for ANJEC, the Association of New Jersey Environmental Commissions. The comments I'm making today are just based on what I've heard here this morning, and we hope to submit some written work to you in the near future. The first request that I would have is that you have named something called the LANDS model, which you're going to be using, and it's going to have significant impact on the product that appears. One of the experiences that we had with the draft was that we did not have a clear, accessible explanation of how things were aggregated together. I would urge you to issue some form of technical guidance or technical paper on that model, on your LANDS model, so that people who are attempting to apply the RMP in their communities can go to that easily and find out what the assumptions were that were used in the creation of the data. So my first request would be for a technical paper on the LANDS model. It might not be a bad thing to engage some form of education about that model as well. The next comment has to do with issue number four, the growth capacity of developed lands. It was very nice to see the list of five indicators that would be used. Again, we did have verbal explanation, a very brief verbal explanation of economically underutilized indicators and local conditions indicators. It would be well for you, I think, to specify very clearly what those indicators are and what the assumptions are that are used in their application. The next comment has to do with transportation. It seems that what you presented here today is focused almost entirely on surface transportation. There are air transportation concerns within the Highlands region and in the nearby region surrounding it. I would urge you to consider something on the subject of air in the RMP. And then there's an odd form of transportation called pipelines. We have a number of pipelines that are crossing the Highlands region. They are regulated by the federal DOT and therefore considered to be transportation components. They can have powerful influences on many things. If they're natural gas, development is certainly related to them. So I would urge you to consider some exposition of pipelines within the Highlands region. Finally, on transportation, on the subject of rail transport, the Highlands was at one time crisscrossed by numerous rail lines, which are no longer in place. Those have potentials for recreational resources. They constitute intact right-of-ways in some situations, and they're also probably the best route for reestablishing rail connection. So I would urge you to map historic rail lines within your transportation planning. You might want to drop the line weight down to make it look like it's something receding into the past, but there are only so many places you can lay a rail line. And folks figured that out at one time all through the Highlands. The subject of septic densities and karst together are related elements. When you apply a nitrate dilution model, you should be aware that your larger lot sizes will appear on your best aquifers. Throughout the Highlands region, there are relatively small areas which are actually your very best future groundwater sources. These areas are in limestone valleys overlain by glacial drift, sands and gravels from the last glaciation. Be aware that when you treat karst formations only as a problem and not as a resource, you may be missing important things about the future. Karst aquifers are valuable future water resources, not simply problems to be dealt with by local ordinance. So I would appeal to you again to reconsider some policy statements about karst within your new RMP. The approach that you've taken in today's paper basically is a necessary approach. You want this local ordinance to be in place. You want this mapping to be done. There may be a technical problem in mapping the drainage areas onto the karst. It's the same problem you have with the lake communities. So that may not be doable until you get your LIDAR data. But that's the right approach. Anyway, it's a necessary but not sufficient response to the problem of karst. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Wilma Fry, New Jersey Conservation Foundation. I guess I have, I don't know whether you can answer a question, but I'm wondering if there are any like background papers that go along to supplement this document here that were prepared for the council that we'd be able to have. I mean, this is very compressed, sort of shorthand document, and so not to your knowledge. Okay, thank you. I'd like to thank Councilmember Carluccio for pointing out a lot of important issues regarding the water supply and septic issues on here, which I will need to study in more detail to be able to comment on. I guess I have a couple of concerns. One is the vernal pool boundary issue, and the other is the state plan designated centers issue. I think that there should be a firm limit on the vernal pool boundary. I think that even this document indicates that terrestrial habitat can range from 400 to 4,000 feet, so 1,000 is already a sort of a compromised number. And managing and monitoring the kind of zones that are proposed can be extremely difficult. On the state plan designated centers, I totally agree with the idea that the constraints and the environmental resources that are within the center area really need to be mapped, as well as the center itself, because that is really what the issue is where is the center appropriate and prep, and where is it perhaps not appropriate. Otherwise, it will simply be used as a way to reinforce a development proposal rather than being viewed objectively in the context of the regional master plan. So the purpose of mapping them would be to compare them with what is in the RNP, not simply to indicate where they are located. So we will address these in writing at a later time. Thank you.
Thank you. That was the last. We don't have enough votes to adjourn, but our next scheduled meeting is 2 weeks from today, September 20th at 10 o'clock. So thank you all. Okay.